Even if we do something wrong and we know we're doing something wrong, don't we attempt to rationalize it in our own mind and to our friends to justify what we're doing? So I believe it's a great fallacy to set out to brand those whom we disagree with as being evil people. The result of their actions we may perceive to be evil. We may perceive it to be bad. But I guarantee you those people don't see it that way. And when we present ourselves to them in that light, we're good and they're evil, do you think we have a chance of getting them to listen to us? Not on your life.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 10 past five. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. Thank you for all you faithful hanging on in there. Yeah, we've had a few technical problems since we've been away. Something peculiar has happened to the wire, which goes between my laptop here and the clips and Dave's desk. And so we're going to have to be playing those clips in actually off of a microphone since it's on our desk here, which is a bit irritating. I don't know if someone's trodden on it in the meantime. But anyway, we finally figured out why it wasn't working, and now it sort of is, just about. Anyway, welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday, the 3rd of May, 2024, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol. On the talkradio.org.uk stream. That's the easiest place to get straight to the stream. Is just plug in talkradio.org.uk. It pops up. I always use a little thing on the left-hand side to listen, and I've been listening to the show live the last few weeks, which has been a bit weird. And it seems to work, that thing. At radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, which Nick informs me has just been updated on the Apple too. So whether it's an Android, evil Android, or evil Apple, wherever you're getting it from, whichever operating system, it all updated and working swimmingly by all accounts. So Aurora is the better place rather than Google Play. If you can find that and download the Aurora app, that's the thing to do on your Android phone. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade propaganda psyops, the puff pieces on the conspirators, and the hatchet jobs on the heroes, the McCarthyite witch hunts going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity and against the World War III and wage slavery lies. Well, they can curse them, but they can't necessarily silence them. The idea is that you character assassinate people, but we're getting so used to this, aren't we, that it's almost like we're not taking any notice of it anymore. The twisted accelerationist Armageddonist policies designed to make every crisis worse, and the politicians have nothing to say. The behaviourist Dark Enlightenment drones, the cowards and control freaks want us slaves to their machines. Actually, I remember, I think it was in a Daily Telegraph article discussing the BBC staff and managers as cowards and control freaks, which rather made me laugh. I think I know exactly what they mean. And many BBC employees will, if they dare, will smile too. The pantheist wife-murdering WEF king, Champon Charlie, waging war on the British people, as well as China, Russia and the BRICS, with regime change maniac sidekick and referendum failure David Cameron. So, helping us navigate the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, or the Fourth Reich Matrix, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Hi, Martin.
Hello.
Have you missed our little chit-chats?
Well, I have. It's been nice to have a break, but obviously I've got loads and loads of things that I think about in the week, and this is my opportunity to get some of it off my chest.
It is. The big story today, of course, is the local elections. Labour have done extremely well. Do you feel like it was a good idea to stick with the Labour Party, as you have done?
Well, I mean, the options in our very limited system are limited. So, you know, in a different kind of setup, you could have a much more free-ranging debate. But it's a designed system, designed to lead to conservative, oligarch-friendly outcomes. So, in one sense, it's good.
Or Labour, oligarch-friendly.
Oh, yes. Yes, that's right. So, you've got to vote Labour to get the Tories out, but then the Labour Party's in the pockets of the oligarchy. That's the system. It's not a bug, it's a feature. So, yes, it's a good job that the Tories are finally going to go to the knacker's yard. But the reality is that the same sort of policies, particularly in foreign policy and economic policy, are going to continue.
What about,
it's not decided by the national government. It's decided by the deep state, isn't it?
What about in Scotland? We've seen lots of changes up there, haven't we, this week, just within the space of a week or so, with the initial thing being the government in Scotland pulling out of their climate commitments, and the Scottish Greens pulling out of the coalition, and a sort of cascade ever since.
Well, it wasn't that the Greens didn't pull out of the coalition, as I understand it. The SNP broke the arrangement that they had with them. The Greens were prepared to continue with it, although perhaps they may have, you know, I think the SNP perhaps got their retaliation in first and kicked them out before the Greens withdrew their support. Yes, I mean, that is coalition politics. And don't forget that there is a political crisis going on in Scotland, in Britain, in the United States, in the United Nations. There's a global political crisis. So, you know, there is definitely a storm in Scotland, but it's a teacup storm as part of the general storm that everybody else is having.
It's been, a bit of a disaster up there. I look at Tony Blair, because it was him that started this process of devolution. Wasn't it always bound to be incredibly fractious? So even though the Scottish people voted to stay within the United Kingdom, that you've got the Greens and the SNP both saying, well, actually, they got it wrong. We're going to carry on campaigning for a Scottish referendum and to break away from the United Kingdom.
Well, the point I just made a minute ago is that the system is an oligarchic system designed in the first place by an English oligarchy, which then aggrandised the state here, conquered Scotland and absorbed it, conquered Ireland and absorbed Wales. And ultimately, just like Yugoslavia, this is a multinational state. It always has been, Tony.
So is this just this is naturally reverting to type? Nothing to do with Tony Blair?
Well, Tony Blair allowed devolution to happen because he was under enormous pressure from the Irish, for example, who went to war with us in 1920.
No, he did it because he was setting a rabbit running for the European Union to regionalise Britain, to break it up, because it was going to be part of a Brussels empire.
Okay, that's your interpretation. My interpretation that the English state...
Why did he do it? He was intimidated by the IRA?
No, he was intimidated by the fact that he had to do it because the pressure in Scotland on him was enormous. The Scottish people wanted devolution, and they had two referendums to get it. They passed it the first time.
The Scottish people didn't want it.
They
had the referendum.
Devolution. They had two devolutions referendums, Tony.
But they didn't want independence,
Hang on, let me finish. You've asked me a question. I'm trying to answer it. They had two devolution referendums. The first devolution referendum, even though they got more votes, they weren't allowed to have it because that referendum was a designed referendum where you had to get at least 55% of the vote and a certain amount of turnout before it would be activated. So, in actual fact, most people in the first referendum voted for devolution, but they couldn't have it, and they had to wait for a second referendum, which they did, in fact, manage to get devolution. That was the demand of the Scottish people, Tony. People in England didn't want it. People in England basically ignored the Scots and didn't care what they thought. Scots didn't think like that.
John Sweeney's about to be crowned king of Scotland, isn't he, basically? I mean, I look at this whole political process as 40 years of journalism or so I've been doing, and I just think the whole thing is a setup. The whole thing behind the scenes has been arranged where he's just going to be crowned king of Scotland. Now Hunza Yunus, and the reason Hunza Yunus had to step down wasn't just because of this rift with the Greens, it was because he's immensely unpopular. I don't know if you've seen the actual popularity, and obviously the Scottish, as they go into a couple of years into an election campaign, they need to have a leader who's electable, and he's not.
Well, that's what he's concluded. That's why he's resigned. He hasn't been forced out. He resigned. He said, I've made a mess of this, and I put my hand up and say I'm resigning. The idea that this kind of chaotic sort of churn that we're talking about...
I don't see it as chaos at all. You do.
Right, well, I think, Tony, that you are trying to read everything in terms of the EU. I think NATO is much more important.
I actually didn't
NATO
talk
is far
about
more
the
important. The EU
Why is
part
the
of
EU the... behind Hunza Yunus and John Sweeney then?
The EU isn't behind Hunza Yunus.
I didn't say it was?
No, you are trying to suggest that everything that goes on in politics is something to do with the EU. The EU is quite an important issue in politics, but it's not the only one.
It's a very powerful influence, but I didn't say that about Scotland at all.
No,
I said
Scotland's
what's going
got its
on.
Own, got its own internal politics, nothing to do with English politics, and nothing to do with the EU directly.
The main job of Scotland seems to be to make it a good place for Americans to invest.
Yes, and the same has happened in Independent Ireland, where they kicked the British out, and they've actually got low rates of tax, and most of the economy is totally dependent on US investment. The problem with the British economy now outside the single market is we've got no foreign direct investment coming in, and that's why our economy is in the doldrums. Unlike the Russian economy, they're outside the EU and outside NATO, and they can pursue an independent
policy.
They're
doing extremely well, aren't they?
Yes, they are. They're pursuing the kind of policy that we could have pursued in the past, but we can't now because the system is rigged against it.
It is.
Which is why we're going to lose World War III and the Russians are going to win.
It's called finance capitalism. Anyway, so we've got the local elections here with mayors and this sort of thing. Now, there's lots of... I've got the stats in front of me on the BBC's website. Now, here in Bristol, and I'm not sure if other cities are the same, there may be one or two, they haven't counted the ballots, which I find rather weird. Well, it's not weird, it's creepy, because what's happening to the ballots? Are they being properly looked after? Is it by private security? Are there entrances into the buildings where they're being kept that we don't necessarily know about? Why would you feel the need to keep ballot boxes sitting there for 24 hours before you're counting them? So, obviously... Now, there are other weird things about these elections, like you get a pencil to make the mark with. Someone could come along with a rubber and just put an X in a different box if they felt so inclined. So these elections, to me, seem to me less... And then this, I think, was the first election that I've ever been to where they demanded to see my ID, Martin.
I think the ID is a more... pertinent point than the arrest.
Well, they're all pertinent, aren't they? Surely they're all less make these elections less open and less easy to scrutinise.
I would suggest to you that the council officials who are responsible for this election would be offended by you suggesting that.
I don't care if they're offended.
Okay, but I suggest
that's my job.
All right. Well, I'll say it for them.
People who take. I think 48 hours to count the ballots. Yes, you count them as soon as they're shut.
Well, it depends what country you live in. In India, the election goes on for 6 weeks because it's such a big place. The practicalities of elections are not necessarily set in stone, Tony.
Even in India, there's no reason why they can't count them straight away.
Well, the reason they didn't count them straight away probably in Bristol is just money. Because in actual fact, if you have to have people staying up all night to count, you've got to pay them double time. Whereas if they count them in the day, you can just pay them on the normal rate.
Well, if you haven't got enough money to pay for your election, then you shouldn't have a government.
Well, you shouldn't bother our own elections. You don't need elections if we can't afford to pay for them.
What we know so far, though, is that I think the biggest, most shocking change in the number of councillors across the country is which party, Martin? Which party?
What are you driving?
Councillors across the country.
Yes.
What's the biggest? Which party's had the biggest change?
The Conservatives have lost a lot.
They've lost half their councillors in Britain.
Yeah.
They've gone. They're now only at 315. Yesterday they had 623. So they've lost half the councillors across the country. Now, at that point, you would have thought it's time to have a leadership election in the Tory party. But no, all these weaselly politicians are coming forward. Oh, no, we have thoroughly support Rishi Sunak. So you can tell what's going on here is the Tory party is self-destructing, self-immolating, committing suicide in order that Keir Starmer is definitely going to win the next general election.
I think I am a conspiracy theorist, Tony, but your take on politics is always to see a hidden hand.
Okay, would you just explain why it is that with such a disaster in the local... I mean, it really is. They've lost half the councillors across the country. The Conservatives still think Rishi Sunak's the man.
Some of them do not. The head of Conservative Home was on Radio 4 saying we're going to have to try and get rid of him. But most of the people in the cabinet, for example, are leery of having a further Tory election, which will mean that the 80,000 elderly Tory voters will get to choose yet again another lemon for the Tories as we run into the end zone of a rugby match where it's actually a general election's coming. If the Tories spend some time now having an internal party election, which will possibly go to their own grassroots members, the rest of the country will be it'll be very good for us as the Labour opposition if they do.
So it is a game?
No, it's not a game.
Well, you said a rugby match.
Well, all of these things are games, Tony. It's a metaphor. We could discuss it in terms of warfare, if you like.
I don't see it as a game. I see it as something which is basically theatrically managed.
It is theatrically managed, but it's not. But the problem for the Tory theatre managers.
If the Tory party wanted to win the election, wouldn't they just get ditch Sunak and have a leadership election? Probably. I mean, the amazing thing is, of course, you've got idiots like Liz Truss who are put forward as an alternative kind of force within the Tory party.
Actually, she would definitely put her name into the hat. And she would probably get the same vote last time that she got from the 80,000 members of the
Tory. I doubt it.
So she'll
after
be back.
The disaster from last time.
Oh, no. Yes. No, the problem for the Tories is that the party infrastructure is archaic.
Did you see
And they've also lost all trust within Middle England.
Do you think
they've lost it? And they're not going to get it back in the time that they've got
the
on the
1922
clock.
Committee vice chair. Was it 3 weeks ago? Was the guy who was caught up in this? This is the little organisation of backbenchers that manages the leadership challenges in the Conservative Party. Was caught in a sex sting, wasn't he? Did you see that? I had to laugh. I thought, wonder who's behind that? Couldn't be you, possibly, Rishi, could it? And it couldn't be the Conservative Party. In fact, the people who were caught in this sex sting were saying to anyone else who's been sent these WhatsApp messages in a similar fashion, please talk to the police and not the party. Well, what message does that send you? It tells me that the Conservative Party apparatchiks have decided Rishi must be protected at all costs so that the next election can be stage managed.
They're protecting Rishi at all costs because that's what you do in a rugby match. You don't allow the other side to get the ball and you try and keep it.
Well, the other side is your own side, actually. This is the potential winners of the next election on your own side that you're going against.
Well, look, there is manipulation.
No, it's very difficult to get you to see it from the Tories' point of view.
No, I am seeing it from the Tories' point of view, and if I was a moderate Tory of the Jeff Gollop type, I would be rolling my eyes in horror at everything that's happened since the 1980s, really. They've basically dug themselves into the biggest hole you can imagine by pursuing an economic policy which failed in 1982, and they're still talking about it as some kind of potential saviour of the country policy. And of course, as we know, as Nigel Farage said, the purpose of Brexit was Liz Truss's economic policy. He said, best budget ever, just before the pound crashed. And there has been a complete collapse of foreign direct investment in Britain. That doesn't immediately affect things, but over the next 2, 3, 4 years, our economy will go sinking downwards as a result of the policies pursued since 1982 in this country, including Brexit.
I would totally agree. So Labour has done quite well, not as badly as the Conservatives. So they've picked up, they've now got 832 councillors. So that's coming on for three times the number of Conservative councillors across the country. They've added 130 so far to their number of councillors, which is roughly half of the fall that the Tories had. Lib Dems done quite well. They've added 50 to, they're now up at 276. Independents have also done well, up about 80 to 180 around the country. Greens have done not so well necessarily. I mean, they've only added 36, but the thing is they were only around about 50 or so beforehand. So, yeah, I mean, that's what we're seeing around the country. The Greens, yeah, Greens are on the up. Indies are on the up, Lib Dems are on the up, Labour is on the up. Almost all of the these new seats have come from the Conservatives. The Conservatives have basically gone off a cliff.
Yeah, I think that's pretty clear. I mean, it's not unexpected, and the level of defeat is probably in terms of what most people who were looking at it were expecting. And it doesn't bode well for a general election anytime soon,
so
does it?
We've had a... Well, of course not. No, and you know, Sunak is definitely... Seems to me going to just hang on and hang on by his fingernails as long as he possibly can in order to try and say, oh, yes, my policies are working. I need just a bit more time to prove it to you. And then it's all going to end in tears.
Well, what may happen, as you suggested earlier, is that some Tories will decide that it's probably worth the gamble of trying to remove Sunak. So then we will have yet another of these whole... You know, Tories talking to themselves about who should run the Tory party. I don't think it'll do them any good. And what may well happen is that Sunak will survive that. Yeah? because enough sport will be with him to, because he'll say, look, I'm the continuity candidate. These people are wreckers. Don't go with them. And he's not going to go quietly. So what we could see, and it really will be get the popcorn out time, is as we go into possibly World War III and economic collapse, the Tories are going to be talking to themselves about who should leave the Tory party, even though in actual fact they've got no chance whatsoever of winning a general election. They might as well just call an election now. Why don't they just call one now and let's just have one right now this minute?
So here in Bristol, sorry, we don't have those election results until tomorrow, but we do have a new police and crime commissioner, for what it's worth. Is it worth anything, Martin? How much is it worth to you in terms of pounds, shillings?
I did vote. On the police and crime commissioners, but I don't think police and crime commissioners are a sort of totally useless, pointless thing to have. They don't have them in Northern Ireland because obviously it was an absurd idea to allow elections to who's going to run the police force in a potential civil war country.
Well,
have got to be independent and seem to be independent.
But Martin, they had them in Batman.
Yes, well, maybe that's
Commissioner Gordon.
That's right, and that's why we've got them, because David Cameron went to the US and they have police and crime commissioners, so that's what he wanted. I don't know what the Tories were thinking of. Maybe they thought that middle-class householders would be able to pressurise the police to do more about burglary and stop bothering about all this child sex abuse.
Well, the idea is that they're holding the chief constables to account for the electorate, but they don't really seem to have been doing that very much.
Well, in any case, who are the electorate? If it's party political, are the chief constables going to be held into account by the Conservative electorate? If you've got a Conservative police and crime commissioner, or a Labour, the Labour electorate? If they don't have this in Northern Ireland, because whoever won, say the Republicans won police and crime commissioner elections, the Loyalists would be horrified, because then the Republicans would have control of the police, and vice versa. That's why the Royal Ulster Constabulary was disbanded, and a whole new organisation was created to depoliticise the police force. So the creation of police and crime commissioners is a potentially dangerous thing, apart from being pointless. Because, of course, if they do anything, they're dangerous.
The idea is that the police may be independent, but they're corrupt. In other words, there are a lot of police who have links to organised crime. And so the idea is you've got somebody to kind of keep an eye on them.
Yes, well, the police and crime commissioners may be corrupt as well. I mean, the point is, corruption in the police is corruption. It's got
to
be dealt with.
Especially when they're too close to the business community.
Well, indeed. I mean, there's always going to be an issue with that. But having a politician, a party political politician, who is obviously going to be divisive, whichever side they come from, in charge, does not solve that problem.
One of the big issues in the city here is our clean air zone. Lots of discussion always about that. It's very doubtful whether anyone could really call it in any way green, since it makes people drive much further around, usually an extra sort of mile or couple of miles, and producing more pollution. There's all sorts of other things, like the giving planning permission for the incinerators in Avonmouth, which just drifts pollution across the city. The other factor is that you've got a narrowing of the roads in the city centre, which has massively reduced the total number of cars, and these massive new Chelsea tractors don't pay a penny, so it's really a tax on the poor. But there was a discussion, there was a news item just the day before our local election, that was on Wednesday here, on Radio Bristol, about the clean air zone. It was interesting to see. I think it starts with Kai Dudd, who's a Labour councillor, and then there's one of the Green candidates, and then finally we get our old friend Mark Weston from the Conservatives saying what they think about this clean air zone and whether it's a good or not thing or not, because it's... I mean, I'm on the Clean Air Zone Facebook group, and I've noticed on there, for example, somebody who drove through the Clean Air Zone and she had to go very fast to get out by midnight, because if you don't get out by midnight, you have to pay twice. You have to pay for that day and the next day. But she got a ticket at 5:02 midnight, and then another ticket at 1 minute past midnight. So she'd only just been through the city, but she had to pay twice. That's £18. A lot of other people just simply don't notice it or don't know it's there. But anyway, it's been extremely controversial. Most people feel like they're being mugged. We had an interview a few weeks ago from a musician who said he and his friends just don't won't play in Bristol anymore because they're often playing in the evenings and it's far too expensive. I mean, they don't hardly make any money as musicians anyway. And so to have to actually pay £18 per vehicle to bring them in to the city and out again, it's just not worth their while anymore. So anyway, it's still there. Allegedly, it's something to do with pollution, but actually many people think it's more to do with just raising cash because the council is so cash strapped after 2008 and the Lib Dem coalition started to take away the money from local authorities.
Our next question comes from one of our producers who's got the message. Kaz.
Yeah, Tom has been in touch and says, are clean air zones here to stay? Isn't it just pushing the problem out further? And would you look to increase it outside of the current area?
I'll put that one to you, Kite. Just to qualify, launched in November of 2022, it was a long time coming, the clean air zone for Bristol. Originally, I remember talking about this a decade ago, it started at the Hambrook Lights, and it's just got smaller and smaller and smaller to the clean air zone that it's got. It's currently running at the moment. After costs, it made £26 million in its first year. Is it here to stay?
Well, our view, it's here to stay until we get legally compliant air, which we're on track to do in the next couple of years. So,
and then when you get legally compliant air,
that's it, as far as we're concerned. So, unless regulations change around higher standards in terms of air quality, we think the CAS has done its.
So, just so I'm clear in my head, if the air was legally compliant, how long would that be? A year, 2 years? I mean, you've got to have it.
I think it's 2025. It's due to become compliant. So, our view is that. I mean, it was a very blunt instrument anyway, but we supported it to deliver that compliance, and as soon as it delivers that compliance, as far as we're concerned as Bristol Labour, it's done its job, we've got no plans to expand it, although I did hear that there are green candidates calling for the clean air zone to be expanded, so it'd be
okay. Good, well, we'll let the green candidates answer for themselves in just a moment. So if it's clean for a year, you get rid of it, Heather, for the Greens.
So it really disappoints me that the ambition... So the clean air zone was brought in because 300 people a year were dying from unclean air in Bristol. When we talk about deaths that come from traffic accidents, from bikes or scooters, one death is too many. 300 deaths a year from polluted air. I am not aiming just to have the legal bare minimum. When I am talking about the safety and the health of the people in Bristol and our impact on the environment, I am not going to go for the bare minimum that is currently, when we have a Conservative and an environmental government, and I know this is WHO or global standards.
So, okay, that you're talking about central government. Let's talk about Bristol.
Nine in ten journeys are compliant at the moment.
Let Heather finish. I'm going to give everybody a chance and then you can come back. But for now, Heather, come to your point, please, for the local election.
Yes. So I would not, and I don't think the Greens would, base this purely on what is the legal limit. We can see that the clean air zone is having an impact on the standard of our cars, the emissions of our cars. That's both carbon emissions, environmental emissions, as well as the air quality. And that will be improving the health of people who often, some of the most deprived communities we have, that live in central Bristol. It's these kinds of methods that help behaviour change. Yes, they're hard to get used to, but when they are in...
Would you continue with it?
We would continue
even if it was compliant?
We would continue to look at the data, but if that is money that we can spend on public...
Thank you, Carmen. I'll ask the question.
Yes.
So you would continue with it even if it was compliant for
if
a year?
If that is money that we can... That money
would
we
you
are
expand
spending
it? Would you expand it beyond its current position at the moment?
I think that there's a lot of data we need to look at there, so I'm not going to state that because there's also...
So you're not ruling out... Just so I'm clear, because people have got to vote for this. Mm-hmm. They've got to vote for you and make a decision. You are not ruling out expanding the clean air zone.
I'm saying that I'm not ruling out expanding it or not expanding it. I'm saying that there's a hell of... We've only just got 1 year's worth of data.
It's really important, this, because it took a long time to establish this, and people need to know so they can make an informed decision. You are not ruling out a possible expansion of the clean air zone as the Green Party.
I'm saying that neither side is on the cards right now. I think these sorts of decisions take years of looking at data to come to. So... you know, it's not in our manifesto. It's not something that we are immediately planning to do. I don't think you can ask us what might be happening a few years down the road.
I think I can ask you.
You can ask. You can ask.
I think everybody has the right to ask you.
Of course.
Whether you give an answer is a different thing. Right, thank you for that. From the Conservatives, Mark Weston.
Hi, I'll keep it simple. No, as soon as we are legally compliant, we think the cash should come off. For us, it's actually causing barriers to communities trying to access work, family relations, everything else. You have roads like the Portway, which was never actually over the legal limit and they got included. So for us, it's actually very straightforward. As soon as we are legally able to do so, the cash should come off.
So there we have a clip from BBC Radio Bristol where the Greens, the bombshell that they may actually expand the Clean Air Zone just one day before the local election. So there's been a sort of a row over this. Martin, what do you make of it?
Well, I think the thing that to state first of all is that this has been carried out because there is a legal requirement to get the air quality improved because of the reasons that the Green councillor or candidate was saying. So in other words, it would always have been the case, even if we had a Tory council, that had to do something to get the air quality compliant. Now, you might argue that we shouldn't bother with getting air quality compliant, but that's a national issue because it was decided at national level that that's what should be done. And it may also be something to do with EU regulations, which I'm just not the au fait with what was behind all of that. So we've now got a quite clear spread of views there. The Labour Party is saying, as far as they're concerned, if we're compliant, then they can get rid of it. And the Tories are backing that up and saying, yes, as soon as we're compliant, we should get rid of it. The Greens are saying, no, we shouldn't necessarily get rid of it, but we're not saying whether we're going to increase it or not. We're going to look at the data and then make up our minds. Now, in actual fact, that's a quite straightforward choice for the electorate, isn't it? Those who think that clean air is more important than other things can vote Green, and those who don't can vote against
it. The Greens get closer to power, they become just as weaselly as all the other parties there. She's just sort of trying to... She obviously does want to expand it, but she just doesn't want to admit it the day before the local election.
Well, I think she's made a quite clear green water between her and the other two candidates. They're not going to get rid of it.
The Lib Dems want to keep it. And they may expand it too, apparently.
So, in other words, the Lib Dems and the Greens are clear they want to keep it and possibly expand
maybe
it.
Not. Yeah, yeah.
The Labour Party and the Conservative Party... otherwise. So in other words, people have got a clear choice there. You make up, you know, you pay your money, you take your choice.
Yeah,
that's a clear choice,
isn't it? Wasn't quite clear, because that's not what she said. This is why I use the word weaselly, because they know that it's extremely unpopular, but they've been sort of thinking about
it. Well, we'll see about that when the ballots are counted this evening, Tony. We will see what the electorate thinks. And it may well be that the Greens, with their commitment to keeping or increasing the zone, are in charge of the council, which suggests that they have got the support and the people who are opposed to it haven't.
Well, it might just be that they're fed up with Marvin, because this is the other thing that's going on, isn't it? That Marvin, the Labour mayor, is so unpopular that he's managed to get his own position abolished. And we've got a bizarre situation, haven't we, that we had this Metro mayor as well created here in Bristol, which was for a larger region. Remember at the time, you and I discussing this on BCFM. On FM and saying, well, isn't it interesting, because the Labour the Bristol mayor is almost certainly going to be left-wing or Labour of some sort, one sort or another, and so they've got a new mayor who includes loads of Somerset and South Gloucestershire, loads of rural areas that might well be a Tory. So what's happened is this role, which is most likely to be a Labour person, has now been abolished to be replaced by this person that's most likely to be a Tory.
Well, it was abolished because there was a campaign by many people who used to come into our show and have come into our show.
Well, the Lib Dems mainly here.
Well, the Lib Dems and others to get rid of the having mayors. And they've forced a referendum, and they won the referendum with far less than 50% of people participated in. So the idea that there's any great wish for having a mayor or not having a mayor is pretty silly. Far less than 50% voted in both of those referendums. But if you see in Scotland, when they voted on devolution, as we're talking at the beginning of the show, at least 50% or 60% had to participate, and they had to get 55% of the vote. In the National Union of Mine Workers back in the day, a strike ballot had to have 55% support to be valid. That was the internal rules of the NUM. But of course, the basic rules in British, you know, playground politics are, if you can get, you can force a referendum, you get people to vote, even if it's less than half the electorate, you can then change everything, and then another lot can come along and change it back again. But in actual fact, most people would disengage completely. You know, they didn't care either way. They still don't.
Is that deliberate?
No, it's just because people are not as obsessed with politics as the people sitting in this little cabin.
Well, it's
not people
so
listening.
Much that, is it? It's the idea is that if the population has got a tyranny and a plutocracy, then they do disengage. That's just normal.
Well, I think that does happen, but you can't presume that that's the only thing going.
They get fed up with it all, and they say, "What's the point of even thinking about politics? It's all fixed."
Yes, I know, and of course they've got the luxury of saying that because they know somebody will be elected and everything will carry on anyway. Of course, if you're fighting for a state, as the Palestinians are, the idea that we can just say politics isn't really interested, I'm just going to the shops, isn't really an option, is it?
Yep, sometimes it is, actually.
What, for the Palestinians?
Well, not for
Palestinians. No, I'm just saying the point is that people can take that sort of attitude when they're comfortable enough to take it.
True.
When they're not in a situation like that, then they have to go out and die to have the right to vote.
Luckily, it's not quite as bad as Gaza. We will be talking about Gaza clearly later on after the break. One of the sort of positive things, I suppose, you have to say about the current state of British politics is this chap called George Galloway and the Workers' Party, who revealed some of his plans for a general election this week on LBC.
Well, my colleague Henry Riley reported this morning your talks with two big-name Labour MPs, Claudia Webb, who's former Labour, and Tahir Ali. Are they going to join your merry band, Mr. Galloway?
Well, I hope, actually, that several MPs will, and there's even a Lord. You might say, why would we accept a Lord, Nick? But there's a Labour Lord who is in talks with us, and dozens of Labour councillors, including some that we're fighting. We hope that this growing coalition of people who reject the two cheeks of the same backside politics that we've got in Britain. And we hope to play the role vis-a-vis Labour that Mr. Farage and the Reform Party are playing vis-a-vis the Tories. In other words, we hope to steal their breakfast, lunch and dinner.
What's your ambition? How many candidates do you hope to field, Mr. Galloway?
I'm going to present 200 of them outside Parliament this afternoon, including, you'll like this, Monty Panesar, the ace Indian cricketer,
yes,
former England international cricketer, who'll be our candidate in Southall. We've got a former Conservative UKIP Member of Parliament, Member of the European Parliament, I should say. So people from left, right and centre are rejecting the Tweedledee, Tweedledum politics. Some of them are very, very interesting indeed. Monty, of course, was a great left-arm spinner. And so we could do with him, Nick.
OK. What is it about your policies, do you think, that's attracting people such as Monty who want to skittle out the opposition come the general election?
Very well put. You'll hear me say that at 2 o'clock. reality is that we are, if you like, Labour shorn of identity politics, infatuation with race and gender, wokery and greenery and quackery. We are the real deal. We are the, we do what we say on the tin. We stand up for the working people. And you and I are also working people. If we lost our wages, salary this week, this month, we'd be in trouble. And that's the great majority of people in this island. Our country's falling apart at the seams, Nick. We can't even control who comes into it. We lose track of the people who do. Can't defend the English Channel while we're sailing gunboats in the Red Sea. It's all gone to pot. Not since 1941 have we been in such a state. And so far, there's no Mr. Churchill to step into the breach.
So that's George Galloway speaking this week on LBC. Do you think 200 candidates, Martin, he might do quite well, mightn't he? Certainly he's going to eat into Labour in a similar way to the way Reform eating into the Conservative vote and before them the Brexit Party did.
I think that it's a perfectly legitimate political stance that they have there. But of course, in Spain, for example, it would be absolutely normal, and it is normal in other European countries with proportional systems, that you have a left party to the left of what would be the Labour Party.
In which case, you can't change the system overnight. So surely Keir Starmer should be going to George Galloway and saying, look, we will make some concessions to some of your policies and we won't stand candidates against you in a couple of constituencies if you reciprocate.
Well, that's the
Isn't that a sensible deal to do?
Well, that's the sort of deal that Corbyn...
Would you do that if you were Keir Starmer?
Keir Starmer isn't going to do that.
Would you, if you were him?
If I was him, I wouldn't do it, because I'm not him, so it's irrelevant. Right,
would Jeremy Corbyn do it then?
Jeremy Corbyn might have been open to that sort of suggestion. Yes, but that's exactly what we haven't got. What you've got in, I'll use Spain as an example, but I could use any other European country. In Spain, you've got the Socialist Party, Pedro Sanchez, who's been under pressure to resign at the moment for other reasons. They are what you might call the mainstream Labour Party. They're to the left of our Labour Party, but, you know, Spain's a more left-wing country. I mean, they had a civil war and all the rest of it. But, of course, there is also a left party led by Yolanda Díaz, who used to, he was still in the Communist Party, but it's communist-led, but it's not just communist, and they get 15 to 20% of the vote, and they are the kingmakers in the Spanish Parliament.
But, you know, in the 2019 election, the Tories did deals with the Brexit Party, didn't they?
They did.
And the Brexit Party stood aside. So all I'm suggesting here is that the Labour Party should be doing deals, if that is they are serious politicians, in actually wanting to get power, with people like Galloway. Or maybe they're just going to leave Galloway, see how he gets on, and maybe the next election they might do some deals with him.
If they're not, listen, because the we saw the election results last night and today, the Labour Party under Starmer is on course to have an overall majority, possibly, at the next general election. Under those conditions, they're under no pressure whatsoever to talk to other parties about anything. That's the system. That's the so-called advantage of the first-past-the-post system. They can just, you know, they don't have to talk to anybody. I don't think it's a very good system. It's a rubbish system for all the reasons I keep reiterating week after week. But, of course, it's normal in other countries. Somebody like George Galloway would not be some outside figure. He would be part of the political process, and he would have been part of the political process all along, because you can't marginalise anybody in a proportional system. If you've got 15% of the vote, you get 15% of the seats, and therefore you then have to compromise with those people. But in first past the post, Starmer is under no pressure whatsoever to talk to him, because it's unlikely that he's ever going to have enough votes, either votes or MPs, to make any difference to who governs the country. It's just, in a sense, if I was going to be cruel, I'd say it's performative politics. There's no chance of power whatever down that road in the current setup.
With a third of council results in on Friday, what's clear is Labour is on the march, says Tamara Cohen from Sky News. Labour won the Blackpool South by-election too, with a romping swing. And yeah, I mean, obviously this is looking extremely good for Labour. So you're saying that there's no point in, even if they're going to get a majority in the general election, as it looks like they might, just don't do anything.
Well, they're not talking to people in their own party who don't agree with the direction of travel. So they're not going to talk to people from other parties who don't disagree with it. They may be forced to talk to the Liberal Democrats if they don't get an overall majority, and to the SNP. And that will be a very interesting result if they don't get an overall majority. One of the interesting results that came in is in Oldham, the Labour Party lost seats, and that's because they've lost the Muslim vote in Oldham. And I think that's going to show up in Bristol as well. Now, in other words, Starmer's march to the right wing, especially over what's happening in Gaza, is going to alienate many of his traditional supporters. Now, he can probably say, well, I don't care about my traditional supporters. I'm more interested in winning over ex-conservative voters. But his traditional supporters, and I'm the traditional supporters of the Labour Party, and I include myself amongst them, are incredibly frustrated that we never get to bat. Why don't we ever get to bat? It's because the game is rigged, and maybe we should stop playing cricket and play some other game.
Polling guru Professor Sir John Curtis has said the election is one of the worst, if not the worst ever, for conservative performance in local government elections of the last 40 years.
Well, they've made a pretty comprehensive mess of things, and there ought to be some
stop kind the boats, of... he says. It's a picture of Sunak with the big thing saying, stop the boats, you know. Obviously, the boats are not stopping, are they?
No, they're not stopping anytime soon, whoever the government is, because there's a global crisis. I keep mentioning this, don't I? Global crisis.
It's called organised crime.
Well, it's not just organised crime. Did you see the 7-year-old girl that died trying to get on a boat from the guy
from
Iraq?
That's organised crime doing that.
Yes. And, of course, we also bombed Iraq and invaded it and killed 1 million people.
We're not bombing it now, are we?
We are. We are still wrecking Iraq.
Well, we're wrecking it. We're not bombing it, Martin. The idea that all these people are coming to Britain because of wars is not just simply not true. Many of them are economic migrants. Many of them get across from Africa, across the Mediterranean, because of the destruction of Libya. Yeah. And they're brought here by organised crime.
Yes.
Not one just on their own bat.
No.
They're encouraged to come here for cheap labour.
No.
Yes, they are.
No, this is your line, Tony, and I'm not going to buy it.
Okay, go on. What's your line then?
My line.
Calmly.
The reality is that there's been an increase, a massive increase in migration across the Mediterranean and ultimately trickling into Britain as a result of Western imperialist intervention in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Libya, you mentioned Libya, and of course the attempt to destroy the government of Syria, which won a democratic election, by the way, in 2017, which wasn't recognised by our lot. All of these people have been weaponised by the US deep state to destabilise Europe. Europe is now down to be a failed state, a huge failed state, with lots of migrants coming in, no work for anybody, and who's benefiting from this? The Americans. That's who's benefiting from this. It's not the EU that's shafting us, it's the United States of America and their Israeli allies. They want to send the Palestinians here. They'll send them here. That's what that pier's for that they're building. The US military building that pier is to take the Palestinians out of Palestine and send them across the channel to come here. And of course, if they did come here, it's Britain that created the State of Israel in the first place. So it would be nothing other than poetic justice if they did turn up here. Unlike the Ukrainians, of course.
No, it's poetic justice for them to have their own country. Well, not to be shipped here. That's ridiculous.
All right, I'm just pointing out that
you're being silly, really.
Well, I'm not.
Isn't justice of any sort to rip people out of their country.
No, but once you've actually created a situation where they've got to run away, they've got to run away somewhere, haven't they? The people in Iraq, which has been wrecked by our intervention, have got to run away somewhere if they're going to run away.
Well,
why should they run away?
Actually, surely a better thing would be that we just withdrew any kind of support for the genocide. Isn't that slightly more justice?
Well, I think the other thing we should have done is not go to war in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya and Syria. But we did. And the people who voted for that, they voted Conservative, all Labour, but what they got for that was we went to war with those countries. And plenty of people at the time were in favour of that. They wanted to get rid of the evil Saddam. They wanted to get rid of the Taliban.
Well, he was the guy that the Americans put there.
Well, indeed. But they believed all of that. And we said to them at the time, in our millions, if you go to war with these countries, war is a very serious business. It will cost you. It will cost you in all kinds of ways. It will cost you in terms of what you can't even imagine, but it's certainly going to cost you in your pocketbook. And that's the way it's going to cost you in your pocketbook. You're going to have to deal with the consequences. World War II, at the end of World War II, there were more people on the move now than then. But of course, we're moving towards World War III, and there are going to be even more people on the move. We shouldn't have world wars. And when you talk about economic migrants, don't forget that we have imposed IMF structural adjustment on the whole of Africa since the 1980s, which has wrecked the local economies. We wrecked the economies in Eastern Europe. So we've invaded some places. Other places we've just wrecked by using financial methods. But that still means that people have got to get on their bike and look for work, because they used to be able to find work. Libya was not a failed state when it was destroyed. People were arriving from all over Africa, so they were putting them to work. And they were trying to set up an African setup where everybody in Africa would have a job and all the rest
just,
of it.
Okay,
and
so
we'd bomb them to pieces.
Let's get back to the local and the suggestion about what might happen in a general election. Many people apparently are fed up with the Tories, but aren't rushing to throw their lot in with Keir Starmer either. So they're going in roughly equal numbers over to the Greens and the Lib Dems and Labour. So the Green and Lib Dems split 50-50 and Labour get the other lot of the disillusioned Tory voters. The average Tory to Labour swing in each seat is around 9% compared to 2021, but only 1% compared to last year, suggesting Labour have already sucked as much juice as it can from Tory woes. The numbers still work out to a win for Labour at the next general election, just not necessarily a landslide. Provisional national share estimates based on 2 million votes cast puts them around 35% of the votes as against Tories 26. So it looks like Labour might get in as a result of this. Surely, I mean, there's no way Sunak is going to cause a call a general election anytime soon. It will work out to Labour winning 294 seats, the Tories losing 242, and the Lib Dems winning 38. That would result in Labour overtaking the Tories but falling short of an overall majority, Martin.
Can you just repeat to me again what share of the Labour vote would be at a national election? Because you said it, and I think it was 30-something percent, wasn't it? Tell me again.
Can this is, yes, it's Labour 35,
stop.
Tories
stop
30, there. 26.
Stop there. So on 35% of the vote, Keir Starmer would be in a position to tell everybody in the rest of the country what to do.
Only if he's in a coalition with somebody else.
No, because he gets an overall majority on the first past the post.
Apparently not, no. This is what they're saying, is that the Labour would overtake the Tories but would fall short of a majority.
Ah, well, that's an interesting outcome, which is one I'm thinking that is definitely a possibility. Because of the rightward drift of the Labour Party, people are voting both Green and to some extent Lib Dem as a means of protest against both Tory and Labour. Now, in other words, if Starmer is the biggest party, but even under first past the post, he doesn't have an overall majority, that's when he's got to start talking, maybe to George Galloway.
Well, I don't know if George is going to have quite as many as the Lib Dems.
No, but the point is...
But the SNP.
In Spain, it came down to a minor Catalan nationalist party who decided whether there was going to be a socialist government or not. Because that's what happens under proportional systems. You actually end up finding out what people really think, and then you've got to really negotiate what might be possible.
Anyway, the way neoliberals work is that, especially when they're, as George Galloway says, two cheeks of the same backside, is that they all agree on the economics. What would you like to see on the to change the economy? I mean, this is the enormous amount of wealth that's gone from the poor and the middle classes to the super rich. I mean, particularly during COVID, there was a massive amount of wealth went to the super rich.
Well, the obvious answer to that is that the problem with the first past the post system is the Overton window.
No, I'm asking about the policy.
I'm talking about the policy.
I know you always try and revert back talking about how terrible the system
is. I'm going to talk about the policy.
No, thank you. The policy.
The policy Overton window of the policy is very narrow because of the system. In other countries, the policy window is wider.
What policy should we adopt in order to redistribute wealth? That's a very simple question.
We need to renationalise industries which have been privatised, and of course the Labour Party has finally come out and said we're going to renationalise the rail industry.
No, they haven't, actually.
They've said they're going to do it in a five-year
term.
They're
thinking about it. Yes.
All right, so, but in any case, they're starting...
George Galloway definitely is. He's also talking about reindustrialising, which is very ambitious.
That's right. So we need a complete change in economic policy, and you won't just be able to do it in Britain. You're going to need a whole push across the whole of the developed world to change the policy. And we will change it in the end because the current policy simply will not work.
Well, that depends.
You can't cut your way out of a crash.
That depends if you've got a government that's actually running the country or corporations than banks which are running
the
country.
Well, yes, but even corporations and banks will collapse if the system is badly run, and it is badly run.
They just suck up more and more wealth as people get poorer and poorer.
They do, but ultimately that financialisation leads to crashes. It won't happen in China, and it won't happen in Russia. I think we can say that.
There's a crash because they'll make even more money on the crash.
Well, ultimately, that will lead to civil war, Tony, and it won't be settled by the ballot box.
Maybe they think they can win that civil war.
Well, maybe they do, but I think they're deluded.
Anyway, let's go to Prime Minister's questions this week. See how Keir Starmer, the Labour leader, got on with Rishi Sunak talking about the economy generally and about. In fact, we'll discuss this in a minute. There's been various changes over the last few weeks, which Starmer has announced. And every time I hear one, this is about taking money away from poor people of various sorts, thinking about his massive amounts of money which are going to Ukraine, thinking that's where it's coming from. So we're having to make people sleep on the streets here and have more children in poverty in order to help this guy Zelensky. But anyway, let's have a listen to see what Keir Starmer had to say at Prime Minister's questions about the economy this week.
He wants to abolish national insurance, it'll cost £46 billion, and he won't tell us where the money is coming from.
Yeah, exactly.
We're no closer to an answer. I'm going to persevere, because last year, the Prime Minister was apparently drawing up plans to remove the winter fuel allowance from pensioners. His paymaster general went a step further. He said, these are the sorts of things that we need to look at. So will he now rule out taking pensioners' winter fuel payments off them to help fund his £46 billion black hole?
Yeah. Mr. Speaker, it was this government that just this winter provided double the winter fuel payment to support pensioners. But what is crystal clear, Mr. Speaker, is that we believe that the double taxation on work is unfair, Mr. Speaker. We believe that hard work should be rewarded, and that's why this week we're cutting taxes by £900 for everyone in work. But in contrast, Mr. Speaker, it's Labour's newest tax advisor who thinks pensioners should be taxed more. That's his words, Mr. Speaker. This advisor calls them codgers. He thinks that supporting them is a disgrace, and he believes that their free TV licences are ridiculous, Mr. Speaker. It's Labour who hit pensioners with tax after tax, and they would do it all over again.
So, this, I mean, it doesn't really seem as if he's sort of getting to the heart of the matter, old Starmer, there, does it?
Well, I mean, what he's doing is he's picking up on Rishi Sunak's thinking out loud policy, because, of course, they cut national insurance contributions, and he was suggesting that they should get rid of national insurance payments altogether. And, of course, if you're going to get rid of national insurance payments, I mean, there's a case for having one consolidated tax system. So instead of paying income tax and national insurance, you could just put it as one tax. But you can't just get rid of national insurance and not replace it with increasing income tax, because you've got to get the money from somewhere, unless you change the way you create money, which is another issue, talking about changing economic policy fundamentally. Well, I mean, the issues about, you know, the Tories are talking of cutting taxes. We've got the biggest national debt ever, which they keep going on and on about. It doesn't matter that much, but they think they care about it. So we give £3 billion per year to the Ukraine, and we're going to cut taxes for people who might vote Tory. After the 2008 crash, there is no case whatsoever for cutting income tax for wealthy people.
Well, you say it doesn't matter. Whatsoever. You say the national debt doesn't matter. I mean, surely the banks are going to foreclose on that at some point, and the public is going to have to pay it.
No, if you read your economics textbooks, states cannot be bankrupted. So in actual fact, you could do a lot more to use the fiscal power of the state to create money. You could get rid of the private banking system and just have a nationalised banking system, which is effectively what they've got in China.
Your economy is just going to collapse things. Everyone will say, oh, well, all this money stuff, all these investments and promises aren't worth anything in Britain.
Well, that's probably what's going to happen anyway, but because of the seizure of Russia's foreign reserves by the West. Everybody's taking their money out of Western banks because they can see that it can just be stolen.
It just seemed to be a bit of a crazy, suicidal-ish policy. Anyway, look, the effect of a lot of this economy, twice as many Bristolians now are on the waiting list for social housing compared to 7 years ago, which is a year after the current Labour administration and mayor took over. Successfully doubling the housing waiting list.
It's not the local council that's necessarily responsible for that. There's been a crash and people have lost their income. That's to do with national policy. It's the same all over the country. We've got a huge social crisis building. Far more people are living, young people, children are in poverty now than ever before. And that's because of the capitalist crisis, which has been brought on by the central government policy of the British state in collaboration with its allies.
In 2017, there were 8,266 households on the housing register in Bristol. This has risen steadily over the last few years, now 7 years, and now stands, the latest figures stand at 21,411. So that is pretty much a three times increase in the number of homeless. So that's nothing to do with the council.
In
the old days, a council used to build houses for these people. Yes, now it's decided we're not going to do that anymore. Why is that?
It's because the central government puts limits on what building of council housing. The getting rid of council housing was a crucial...
Is this ever since the Thatcher era?
Getting rid of council house tenants who used to pay regulated rents to the local council were natural Tory Labour voters. By selling them their properties at less than their real value, they were bribed to switch to turn their coats and become Tories. But of course that meant that's where the housing crisis comes from. Because of that policy, we should not have sold council houses. If people wanted to buy a council house, in any case, they should have to be. I don't think they should have been allowed to buy council houses. If they want to buy a house, go and buy a house in the private market. So we've then got a council house for somebody who needs it. But of course, by selling the council house stock to the existing tenants, we then create further down the line, one generation down the line, that's where we are now. All of these people that used to be able to get stable housing can't get it, which is why their kids are moved from school to school and they can't, they've got nowhere to live.
Rishi Sunak is doing over the last week or so, they're saying it's they're going to replace personal independence payments for disabled people with vouchers. Rishi Sunak's plan to replace PIP with vouchers and support, in inverted commas, will make it even harder for disabled and sick people with mental illness to cover the additional costs of managing their disabilities. So this is a little bit, this is one of those things, I look at that and I think, well, so this is to pay for Ukraine, is it?
And also to pay for tax cuts for Tory, potential Tory voters. Well, there's no case for tax cuts at all. You could cut taxes on the lowest earners in order to try and boost the economy, but the wealthy classes in this country need their taxation level doubled in order to get back to where we were in the 1960s. Never mind the 1950s. I remind listeners once again, the top rate of tax in this country in the 1950s was 95%. In the United States of America, it was 96%. It's now less than 40%. And many wealthy people pay no taxes at all.
Disabled people fear losing vital support under cruel, inverted commas, government PIP voucher plan. Critics have accused the government of using mental health as a political culture war, which dehumanises disabled people.
Well, that's exactly what they're doing. They're trying to say to potential swing Tory voters, don't vote for the Labour Party because they won't cut your taxes. We will cut your taxes. And of course, some people actually find it rather pleasant, the idea. This is a very nasty part of the English character. Some people like the idea that poor people are punished.
Well, it's not English, is it? Martin, this is a silly thing to say that it's English. This is in the human nature, actually.
Well, it's all in your Dickens, Tony. Dickens, the great English novelist, was very, very well aware of the nasty attitude of some people with money to people below them in the social hierarchy.
That nasty attitude is not just an English thing at all.
No, but it's for the certain, there's a certain part.
You like to beat up on the English.
Well, yes, but in Sweden, for example, that's not the attitude. Yeah, even wealthier people feel that
I'd like to say, in Britain, it's not the attitude.
Well, it's not my attitude.
It's the Tory party.
Well, it
Excuse
is, yes.
me. It's
it
the
is,
Tory party.
It is, and they're rallying their own troops by saying
and
we're going to
Daily
cut,
Mail.
Yes, we're going to cut your taxes and we're going to make life hard for people with mental
and
health
another
issues.
Story, GPs,
feel good.
GPs like me know better than Rishi Sunak. His sick note culture war hurts us all. This is the end of April in the Metro. Things are improving. However, he wasn't. Hang on, this is a story just about some particular guy. But this is the sick note. The idea is that they're going to try and stop sick notes and say that there will be non-doctors will be decide whether or not you're fit for work or not. It could see GPs banned from signing people off work. So if you go and see your doctor and they say actually you're not fit for work, it's not going to make any difference anymore.
Well,
you're still going to have to go to work.
If they win the election and they bring that in, that's what will happen. But I don't think they're going to win.
Isn't it interesting? I think, well, isn't it interesting the way that the Tories are trying to sort of come up with all these sorts of things to say, you know, to sort of help businesses to force people to go to work when they're sick? Now,
well, it's not
maybe there are some people that lie about taking a sickie, are there?
Well, I think the thing is, I feel like saying, so what is this? The Burma Railway, where the doctors decide you're not unfit for work, but you're going to overrule the doctor because you've got somebody who's not qualified to decide that you are fit for work. That's just absurd. And they're going to have to recruit these people and train them as well. We've got qualified doctors to make these decisions, but we're going to train up a whole load of other people who are not qualified doctors to make these decisions.
And just to make things worse as possible for the poor, the Department for Work and Pensions have got bank and snooping powers, which could allow monitoring of accounts of landlords, carers and parents. The Data Protection and Digital Information Bill will give the Department for Work and Pensions the power to snoop on bank accounts of those claiming benefits such as universal credit as well as the state pension. Now, this to me is getting very close towards being fascistic, the idea that if you're poor, that your bank accounts can be gone through by the Department for Work and Pensions, but if you're rich, they can't.
Well, exactly. I mean, you can see what the class warfare behind all of this. The thing that strikes me about this from an economic point of view is that many of the people that they're trying to force into work, employers do not want to employ them. They're not employable. And I know people in my personal life who, you know, they are not employable. And employers don't want to employ them. if you wanted for out of the good, you know, if you wanted to improve their lifestyle and their and improve them, it may be that some of them could do some work, but it's going to cost you more money to put them into work that they can do than you're going to save by the work they're going to do.
Well, members
and
of the
in those circumstances, Martin, you might as well just pay them off and get on with making an efficient economy.
Members of the House of Lords have raised concerns that these powers will lead to banks refusing to provide accounts to people on benefits. This is because it would require the banks to introduce new systems to monitor the claimants, and then also because you're on benefits and your account is connected, say for example, to a landlord's, they would have to hand over the bank details of the landlord, which they wouldn't want to do. So a Conservative peer, Lord Carroll, said putting additional onerous obligations on banks might make them decide it's too difficult to provide accounts to those in receipt of benefits. So this is, you know, unbelievable, isn't it? A letter signed by 20 MPs and members of the Lords to the Secretary of State for Science and Innovation and Technology said the measures would require banks to sift through tens of millions of bank accounts to identify people on the welfare system, around 40% of the population. It said searching for such signals without reasonable grounds for suspicion would reverse the well-established presumption of innocence.
Well, all of these things in the round.
It's surveillance, isn't it? Really? Yeah, it's Big Brother, basically. All of these, and I'm sure Silky at Big Brother Watch has got a little campaign on this one.
All of these things in the round are a rehashing of ideas from 30, 40 years ago, that the real problem is there's too many people on benefit and they're not doing enough work. The real problem is we've got the City of London, which is a financial cesspit of fraud and malfeasance, and has basically ruined the economy. Many Tory MPs have got stocks and shares and property ownership, and they've done very well. You're talking about the increase of people on the social housing waiting list. At the same time, people who live in Clifton have seen their house prices rise by 300% at the same time. These two things are not unconnected. The wealthy classes have ruined the economy. It's no longer, it's not even efficient. The idea that we've done all of this because it's making the economy more efficient, even though it's more unfair, it's not even true that it's more efficient. A fairer system is a more efficient system, as the Russians are demonstrating.
Isn't
their economy
most,
is booming through
do,
state intervention.
Isn't so much of this to do with the cost of living, the idea that your rent, your electricity, your transport costs, fuel costs, internet costs, all these basics, the water, costs far too much because there's someone, you're paying some fat cat boss to run a privatised version of it, and the money is being filched out from that to pay shareholders. It's nowhere near
That's
the actual
right.
cost of supplying those things anymore. So everything to do with just the basic cost of living has gone through the roof since privatisation.
That's right, and it makes you uncompetitive in global terms.
Well, it does, yeah. This is why China's done so well.
That's right. Yeah. And that's why Russia and China are,
this is
Margaret are doing
Thatcher.
They're doing Russia and China are evolving into mixed economies of the kind that Britain used to be. And of course they're doing it on a much bigger scale and with a much, much improved technology. We can't do what they do because we've got, the Russians have got a nationalized energy sector. The West tried to get in there and steal their resources, but they stamped on their fingers and said, you're not having it.
Yes, Vladimir did. They've never forgiven him for that, have they?
No, they haven't. And the other thing is they've got a nationalized arms industry. So for a tenth of the amount the West spends, they've got better kit and more of it.
Yeah. And they've also got a pipeline of new technology
coming along. That's right. And it's actually, they've got an industrial policy where the government sits down and says, where are we going with all of this? We don't bother with any of that because we just leave it to the City of London to decide that a hedge fund from Belize is the best people
this
to
is
run
Michael Hudson,
Thames Water.
Michael Hudson territory, isn't it?
This is
book. What was it called, his book?
Industrial Capitalism, Socialism... and socialism.
Finance capitalism, industrial capitalism, and socialism. The future of humanity, something like that. What a superhero you are, Michael Hudson. We love you. But anyway, we've got another bit of an interesting guy, Joe Stiglitz. Do you know much about him?
A bit. Yeah, I've read a couple of books.
Because he's been doing the rounds over here. I think he's from one of these universities. There's been protests in the US that we'll be hearing about after the break. But tell us a bit about Stiglitz.
Well, at one stage, his most prominent position, I think, was the head of the World Bank. So he was quite a, you know, senior economist. But in US terms, he's a left economist. You know, he doesn't believe in total free markets. He believes in government intervention. You know, he's definitely not a neoliberal. That's what you could say about him.
And before we hear from him, just a couple of positive stories. Which major city, Martin, here's one for you, quiz, could trial free public transport?
Well, I believe Tallinn in Estonia has already
done
it.
No, in the UK, please. Or just about in the UK.
Oh, right.
Glasgow. Glaswegians aged 22 to 59 could be getting bus and subway travel on the house. Glaswegians, we don't get you to get your hopes up, this article says, but your city could be on its way to offering totally free public transport. Glasgow City Council's officially been given support to develop a pilot that will give locals access to buses and the subway on the house. I must say, actually, here in Bristol, from time to time, you do get free public transport. Coming back from the station on the bus, driver just waved us all in. He said, it's not working. Just come in, you know, because they can't take cash anymore. So if the machine that takes your card stops working, then everyone just gets on the bus for free. Maybe you could sort of nobble it, hack it as you get on and say, I can't pay.
When I was in Bologna years ago, the local communist run city council had very, very cheap bus fares, so they're like 5p. Yeah. But nevertheless, the anarchists I was hanging around with showed me how you wreck the machine so you don't even have to pay 5p. Now, of course, if you're going to charge 5p, you might as well charge nothing. Yeah, that was the anarchist argument. I think they were right. I presume that Glasgow City Council is in fact controlled by the evil SNP, isn't it? There we are.
Who's saying they're evil?
Well, I don't know. I mean, some people think they are. I don't, but well, some people
I mean,
think.
Yeah,
they are.
I'm not a great fan of that lovely Nicola Sturgeon.
Well, she's out.
Only because we know her, and she's now been, you know, it's gone past her sell-by date. But all these politicians seem to do that pretty good. Anyway, another story is to do with unpaid carers in the UK. Half a million of them are not claiming £4,200 a year benefit. What they say is the campaigners and the Citizens Advice and people like that are saying underclaiming is a result of restrictions on taking on paid work and also harsh penalties for accidental breaches of the rules. So if you breach the rules, you get a massive fine. But a lot of it is just that people who are carers don't realise that there is this £4,200 sitting there waiting for you. So there are a few, you know, there are a few sort of almost positive angles to all of this. But okay, so let's now look at Joe. I say positive. Anyone who's a carer, you know, I would encourage you to take that £4,200, obviously. But, you know, maybe the government just says, well, there's a bit of a sting in the tail. If you take this money, we might sue you. Oh,
well,
great.
Well, there's various cases where people have taken part-time jobs and claim the caring. I mean, I can't see why people can't take part-time jobs and claim the carer's allowance. I mean, you could just make the rules. You could make the rules more generous, but don't tell Rishi Sunak.
It's only to make it so that people won't take it up. They can go on about how, you know, they've got this wonderful benefit, but actually what they don't tell you is it's toxic and it's almost, you know, it's not worth having it. Anyway, so...
It's not a lot anyway, is it? £4,000 a year.
Channel 4 News had Joe Stiglitz on this week. I think we ought to at least find out who he is.
He's an economist, but he was at one stage a chief economist at the World Bank. I mean, he's an academic economist, but he's also worked for governments.
Far as I know, he's not one of those people who has been on the Bilderberg conferences. He's not that kind of guy.
Well, I think he probably isn't. I mean, I don't know. I haven't got full details about it, but I've read a couple of his books, and they are, you know, left of centre critique of free market capitalism.
New Keynesian, apparently.
Yeah, New Keynesian.
What means what?
Well, it means that he's, you know, he's
a Keynesian.
He's a Keynesian, it's
not
effectively.
Dead.
Yeah.
Keynes is. Anyway, let's have a listen to see what he had to say on Channel 4 this week.
Well, the neoliberal consensus was that by lowering taxes, stripping away regulations, reducing the size of government, we would free the economy, we would have more economic growth, and everybody would benefit through a process of trickle down. And we've had 40 years of this experiment, and it has not worked. Growth is much slower in the advanced countries than it was, and the benefits of what meager growth we had went overwhelmingly to those at the top, and many of those in the middle and the bottom are actually worse off.
So do you think a less free economy might actually produce more freedom?
I wouldn't use that word. Well, examples are rules are necessary for a society to work. It actually is freeing. If you have somebody polluting, and I have asthma and I die as a result, that's taking away my freedom. So one person's freedom can take away the that of others. And so the way that it's often formulated and framed in conservative circles, where they don't take on the interaction between one person's freedom and that of the other, is just wrong, and compromises the freedom of the majority of citizens.
So when they say you just want more red tape, you want more regulation, you want more bureaucracy, and that's not going to produce economic growth, what's the answer?
That's wrong. And the answer is the most successful countries are entail public investments in youth. You know, you shouldn't have your economic prospects depend on the luck of who your parents are. You don't choose your parents. And so the state is responsible for making sure you get adequate health care, adequate education, and that makes for a more prosperous society.
And so if the centre-left, I mean, this country, that's Keir Starmer, is trying to create a progressive capitalism, what is it? What does he need to do?
Well, he needs to have good regulation, thinking about where one person's behavior infringes, or one corporation's behavior infringes on others, and think about where you can have public investments that liberate, that give more freedom, because you give more possibilities of doing things.
And is that a quicker route to growth?
Oh, clearly, clearly. The growth in the United States is so based on earlier government investments in R&D and technology. You think of each of the areas where we've been successful, it's really based on earlier government investments. I call my set of ideas progressive capitalism because the private sector still has a role, but it's not free to exploit. It's not free to use market power to take advantage of others. It's not free to pollute, not free to exploit. It's trying to redirect the power market to serve society. The economy is supposed to serve society, not the other way around. And neoliberalism got it backwards.
Professor Stiglitz, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, that's a basic economics lesson. I mean, if you look at the Economist, for example, the in-house magazine of the elite, they just believe in free markets as a kind of, it's like an occult belief. You know, the more free markets are, the greater growth will be. And it's just not the case. If you actually look at the 30 years from 1945 to the mid-70s, economic growth was higher in Britain and other countries than it's been since. The performance of neoliberalism in terms of producing, better results is just not there. You do need, you know, countries which get this right are going to win the great race, as David Cameron used to call it. And now, of course, the West, which is absolutely financialized, is up against peer competitors who are not financialized. The sanctions on Russia have allowed the Russians to actually pursue a national economic policy. Since nobody's allowed to trade with them, they're allowed to do what the hell they like and nobody can tell them. And it's actually working very well for them. And there's a lesson there, isn't it? What we've got in the West is we can't do anything to help people because we've got to prop the banks up, because the banks are owned by the private sector and rich people would have to lose loads of money. I mean, this is the real problem in 2008. Even if you believe in free markets, what should have happened there is you just let the banks collapse. But that means the wealthy class is losing their money. They don't quite get this. Full-on free market capitalism means you can lose all your money on one throw of the dice. And they say, well, it can't just be one throw of the dice. No, if you're going to follow through on this, if a bank is bankrupt, it must go down, and everybody who owns shares in that bank must lose all their money.
Well, for many countries, like the Argentinians, have had to put up with this a few times, haven't they? Several times.
Yes. Well, I mean, the Argentina is run by an oligarchy, as Hudson points out in his book. The oligarchy in Argentina keeps all their money in banks in the United States.
So in fact, they're going over to the dollar, aren't they? In fact, they've, right. And they've got this anarcho-capitalist guy, very interesting right. character. If, you know, sort of, well, I mean, it's maybe one of these new types of political leaders that we're starting to see emerge in the West, anarcho-capitalism. Well, so in other words, capitalism run rampant.
Well, that's what he believes in, but of course what's actually happening is the wealthy in Argentina are just moving their money out of the country. The country's being put to the sword. And the wealthy classes are going to just walk away with the money. That's just happened. That's what Argentina has been like for years. It developed in that way in the 19th century. It was the City of London, British capitalists who dominated Argentina, which is why they are, you know, there's quite a lot of hostility towards Britain in Argentina because we are seen as the overlords. But of course, the overlords since then have become the United States. We'll have to see what happens with that, because in Latin America, there's a huge struggle going on between the left and right forces in across the continent.
Before we move away, have a break, and we talk about various things, we'll be talking about green fascism. I thought rather than, could invite various green people in, I'd rather not. I'd rather just talk about how the green movement, as it becomes closer and closer to power, seems to be going more to extreme measures to do with a form of green fascism. And I'll be talking to, we'll be hearing from this Canadian lady who worked for Life magazine here in London in the 1990s, Elizabeth Nixon, about her book, Green Fascism. But before that, what about a West Country Council? Before the break and before all that, after the break, a West Country Council has seeked eviction of an Israeli arms firm from its Bristol offices. Somerset County Council has been targeted repeatedly by the pro-Palestinian campaign group Palestine Action, which disrupted a key executive committee meeting in February. Somerset Council is to pursue legal action to remove an Israeli arms company from one of the council's commercial investments in Bristol, Martin.
Yeah, I believe they own the offices which Elbit Systems have in Bristol. I'm not sure whether they own the factory, because they've got two sites. We've been up to Elbit, the factory, a couple of times. I've been a couple of times. I think we've been a lot more than that. And the Somerset County Council do own the site of their offices, and they've come under pressure to evict them, and they have, I understand, committed to evicting them, because of the pressure they've been put under.
Well, that was on the 25th of April, but just a few days later, let's have a look, the 29th of April, Somerset Council apologises to Elbit following its vote on the arms firm's Bristol tenancy. The building is in the process of being sold off, so they might potentially sell it off and leave them in there, just to have no more responsibility for it. Somerset Council has issued a formal apology to an arms manufacturer following a vote on the future of Bristol offices, which it rents from the council. The council currently owns a number of commercial investments, including offices at Aztec West 600 near Junction 16 of the M5, which are currently occupied by Elbit Systems. Council has approved a motion at the full council meeting in Bridgewater on Tuesday afternoon, agreeing to sell the property as soon as possible to pursue all legal avenues to evict the company, describing it as a major UK's provider of weapons and Israeli defence forces to the Israeli defence forces. The company subsequently contacted the council to state none of the military weapons or equipment it produced was being used to supply Israel in the ongoing Gaza conflict, so the council has now apologised.
Well, I take that with a big pinch of salt. Elbit Systems, its headquarters are in Israel. It is fundamentally an arms company. Now, it may be that their operations in Britain are not supplying the Israeli Defence Forces. I find that very hard to believe.
They're saying it. They're not actually providing. I mean, it's impossible for them to provide evidence unless they let the campaigners and Somerset District Council go through all their offices to see what's going on.
That's right.
And they haven't done that.
They can say that they're not, but they've got to prove it. And in any case, Elbit Systems is an arms company based in Israel. And if you're trying to put pressure on the Israeli government to stop the genocide in Gaza, they're a legitimate target.
And as Alexei Sale says, they lie and they lie and they lie. And they lie, and they lie.
I believe in God, the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, and in Jesus Christ, his only Son, our Lord,
who was conceived by the Holy Ghost, born of the Virgin Mary, suffered under Pontius Pilate, was crucified, dead, and buried. The third day he rose again from the dead. He ascended into heaven, and sitteth on the right hand of God the Father Almighty. From thence he shall come to judge the quick and the dead. I believe in the Holy Ghost, the Holy Catholic Church, the communion of saints, the forgiveness of sins, the resurrection of glory, and the life everlasting. Amen.
On earth at different levels, he knows the king we serve, so he hates and meddles and prays that we all burn and turn to rebels. He tried to get my soul, but I'll never settle. I walk this lonely road from the birth to ghettos. I'll take the gift bestowed and return a vessel. I am the one they chose. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Rebellious and always been a sinner since birth. He knew that it would happen when he put us on this earth. We demonize religion, brought corruption to the church. We know the price of everything, but we don't know the worth. We spend all of our time idolizing false prophets. Comparison's the enemy, stop watching others' pockets. The social system's broken, we divide on every topic. They fabricate the truth and we all monetize the gossip. We know the problems and we see them but don't want to change. We're desensitized to every issue cause they let us profit off of people's pain. In this dystopian age, we are the game that he plays. And all the evil, deceitful people should shake our faith. I never seen God's eyes, but I seen the devil's. He walks with man on earth at different levels. He knows the king we serve, so he hates and meddles and prays that we all burn and turn to rebels. He tried to get my soul, but I'll never settle. I walk this lonely road from the birth to ghettos. I'll take the gift bestowed and return a vessel. I am the one they chose. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Our God is an awesome artist. In perilous times we seek his grace as the world and the times we face turn fake in the face of the devil's mirages. In the midst of the pain, disdain, in the media's push of all this garbage, I pray that you keep your faith as the whole world breaks and the real get disregarded. It's about time that we take it back. The weight's too great for the camel's back. Strong men made life an easy task and now the weak men feminize every act. In the church, in the workplace, every class, on the television screen, in the state of rap. All virtue's gone and it's fade to black. We in hell on earth and it's gonna collapse. Integrity's lost, hedonism, we incentivize gods on the way the revolution will be televised. Gone too far, don't know if we can rectify. At those gates, we will testify. So I'm saying it now, so they counteract clockwise. We are living in times where the wickedness all rise. The intelligent fall while the stupidness all thrive. And the real get pushed aside. Yeah. I never seen God's eyes, but I seen the devil's. He walks with men on earth at different levels. He knows the king we serve, so he hates and meddles and prays that we all burn and turn to rebels. He tried to get my soul, but I'll never settle. I walk this lonely road from the birth to ghettos. I'll take the gift bestowed and return a vessel. I am the one they chose. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
you hear this bullshit they be talking? Every day, man, it's like these motherfuckers are just like professional liars, you know what I'm saying? It's wow. Listen, Bin Laden didn't blow up the projects. It was you and her head. Tell the truth, nigga.
Bush knocked down the tower.
Tell the truth, nigga.
Bush knocked down the tower.
Tell the truth, nigga. Bin Laden didn't blow up the projects. It was you and her head. Tell the truth, nigga.
Bush knocked down the tower.
Tell the truth, nigga.
Bush knocked down the tower.
Pledge no allegiance, we'll invoke the president's speeches. I'm baptized by America and covered in leeches. The dirty water that bleaches your soul and your facial features, drowning you in propaganda that they spit through the speakers. And if you speak about the evil that the government does, the Patriot Act to track you to the type in your blood. They try to frame you and say you was trying to sell drugs and throw a federal indictment onto you to show you love. This shit is run by fake Christians, fake politicians. Look at their mansions and look at the conditions you live in. All they talk about is terrorism on television. They tell you to listen, but they don't really tell you their mission. They funded Al-Qaeda, and now they blame the Muslim religion. Even though Bin Laden was a CIA tactician, they gave him billions of dollars, and they funded his purpose. Fahrenheit 9/11, that's just scratching the surface.
Bin Laden didn't blow up the projects. It was show niggas. Tell the show niggas.
Bush knocked down the towers.
Tell the show niggas.
Bush knocked down the towers.
Like, Bin Laden didn't blow up the projects.
They say the rebels in Iraq still fight for Saddam, but that's bullish. I'll show you why it's totally wrong. Cause if another country invaded the hood tonight, it'd be warfare through Harlem and Washington Heights. I wouldn't be fighting for Bush or white America's dream. I'd be fighting for my people's survival and self-esteem. I wouldn't fight for racist churches from the south, my nugget. I'd be fighting to keep the occupation out, my nugget. You ever clock someone who talked ish, but look at you wrong? Imagine if they shot at you, I was raping your moms. And of course Saddam Hussein had chemical weapons. We sold them that ish after Ronald Reagan's election. Mercenary contractors fighting a new era. Corporate military banking off the war on terror. They controlling the ghetto with the fear of attack, trying to distract the fact that they engineering a crack. So I'm strapped like Lee Malvo holding a sniper rifle. These bullets will touch your kids, and I don't mean like Michael. Your body be sent to the morgue, stripped down and recycled. I fire on house taking that support you would like. You was innocent people get murdered in the struggle daily, and poor people never get ish and struggle daily. This ain't no alien conspiracy theory. This shit is real, written on a dollar underneath the Masonic seal.
That was the Apostles' Creed, followed by Dax, D-A-X, with God's Eyes. And a song for Dave there, which was Creedence Clearwater Revival. I say for Dave because he's just come back from Florida, Louisiana. And the reason I say that is because it's from this thing called... It's actually an album called The Son of Gutbucket, but the original album from Creedence Clearwater Revival... is something bio. So this is all Louisiana-y, but it's anyway, I love that Son of Gutbucket album. If you're one of those people that still does vinyl, get it. It's a fantastic record. Blues, mostly US blues, a few, and there's also, I'm going to be playing, I think, some of those over the next few weeks because they are fantastic. And then we finished off with Immortal Technique, Bin Laden and Mos Def, which the reason I played the Mos Def as well, which I think is 2010 or so that came out from Immortal Technique, is because I've been seeing a lot by this guy called Shoestring911 on Twitter. And if you don't follow him already, do, because if you're on Twitter, he's just absolutely doggedly goes for 9/11. Now, Martin, you and I know how important it is because... the 9/11 investigation, which was Loose Change, probably one of the most well-known documentaries to really pull it all apart. But if every time you go back to 9/11, you start to see why we are where we are today, don't you? Because of all of the crookedness involved.
Well, that's right. It didn't come out of the out of nowhere either, because of course NATO intelligence services have been involved in the commission of terrorist acts almost from the get-go when they absorbed the ex-Nazis like Reinhard Gehlen into the structure. And, it's, you know, once you know the history, it becomes quite clear why we're in the mess we're in.
Well, the idea is that you're supposed to forget that 9/11 was a load of rubbish and a set-up, and For example, Shoestring 911 has been posting loads of this evidence that there was no actual airliner at the Pentagon. Now, the interesting thing I think about, if people want to understand psychological warfare, is that... Dave is shaking his head. Why that, Dave? They're saying it was a cruise missile, not an airliner.
No, though, I had a look at the CCTV image. You can see the tail fin. It's definitely an airliner.
Well, I think that in actual fact, the details of what happened are still to be discussed because we haven't had a proper investigation. The reality is that the official story of what happened cannot possibly be true.
There were two bits of an airliner lying on the lawn of the Pentagon that looked as if someone had put them there.
Well, we could argue about this because...
Small. Pick them up with your hands.
I know. We could go into the detail.
The hole wasn't big enough for an airliner in the Pentagon.
Yes, all right.
It looked like a missile of some sort had hit it and gone through several layers of concrete. Yeah, but, I mean, but there was...
Sorry?
Big enough for the engine.
Right, yes, and the engine apparently was not an airliner engine. Anyway,
we could discuss this in detail.
We're still arguing about it today.
But the most important thing of all is the third building, WTC-7, collapsed into its own footprint at free-fall speed, having not been hit by an airliner.
And so did the first and second airliners. So did the first and second buildings.
Indeed,
really,
in actual fact,
down at free-fall speed.
That's right.
The point I wanted to make was about the psychological warfare aspect of all of this.
Yeah.
Is that the one thing that Richard D. Hall and other disinformation people put out there is that there was no planes at the Twin Towers. Actually, the evidence is there may have been no plane at the Pentagon. Another reason for that was because of the amazing bit of flying that had to be done. This thing apparently came along and turned upside down and round in a very, very short space of time, which most airline pilots would say was impossible.
Yeah, but they were being flown
by remote control.
By remote control. So by remote control, that might be feasible.
But this idea that there's no planes at the Twin Towers is rather than the Pentagon. So the idea is once some conspiracy starts to come to light, what they do is they'll put out a whole load of rubbish about how it's not the Pentagon, it's the Twin Towers that this happened.
Well, exactly.
The idea is just confusion.
That's right.
Confusion, confusion, confusion. And they say things like holograms hit the Twin Towers, all this kind of thing. Yeah. So that's why I like bringing this up from time to time, even though it's not news, it's about how we got where we are. And Martin, I know you've spoken about this quite a bit over the years, but the effect of those September the 11th attacks really was a carte blanche to the good old US of A and Uncle Sam to go and invade any country they wanted to. The Israelis, it now looks like.
Yes, well, I mean, there's lots of evidence that the Israelis were involved, including the five dancing Israelis who were caught filming the first plane hitting the World Trade Center, and then they were noticed celebrating, and their car was stopped later by the local police, and it turned out that they were all Mossad agents, and they eventually were interrogated and went back to Israel, where they said, we were Mossad agents, we weren't doing any harm, we were just documenting the event. But it was supposedly a surprise attack.
But by saying that, you're anti-Semitic.
No, I'm not anti-Semitic, Tony. I'm just acting as if I was a police officer.
It's now getting
investigating
a bit tired,
something.
That sort of old accusation. Anyway.
And of course, the thing about 9/11 was it was very big and spectacular, but then the bombing of Bologna Railway Station in 1980 was big and spectacular. It killed 87 people. Wasn't as many as in the Twin Towers, but the police investigation in Italy has shown beyond any doubt whatsoever that was orchestrated by NATO intelligence services. NATO intelligence services have always engaged in skullduggery. It's their standard operating procedure. You can presume that they're engaged in skullduggery unless they can prove otherwise.
Well, one of the top-notch documents that does point towards all the evidence that the Israelis and particularly joint US-Israeli passport holders were behind the September the 11th attacks. Christopher Bolin's books document that quite a lot, but probably the best article, most easy, which is really well-referenced and links from it to everywhere. A lot of those links to places seem to get taken down and disappeared for one reason or another, but it's on the WikiSpooks website, and it's called 9/11 Israel Did It, All the Proof in the World. So that's a good place to start on the Israelis and the US being behind the September the 11th attacks. Welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show. For those that want to bypass the psycho in the corner on the talkradio.org.uk stream and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores, Aurora please, rather than Google, with Irish Republican, Labour activist Martin Summers, and me, Tony Gosling. We're going to start this week at Gaza, and I try to find the most right-wing British, pro-Israeli British, which has got to be part of the Murdoch Empire, obviously, chatting to one of these Israeli government officials this week, and I found someone called Avi Hyman, who's an Israeli government spokesperson, talking to Talk TV's Mike Graham earlier this week. So see what you make of this, Martin.
Right now, though, let us go to a further eastern point and go to Israel, where Avi Hyman is the Israeli government spokesman. Avi, a very good morning to you. Welcome to Talk.
Good morning, Mike. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks very much indeed for joining us. I mean, all eyes really at the moment on various different conversations going on, whether they're going on in Saudi Arabia or the UAE or Cairo. A lot of effort going in, I suppose you might say, to try to find an agreement on the ceasefire. Hamas being urged to accept this one. They've turned down a few. What can you tell us about where we are on that?
So what I can tell you is that we have put a offer on the table, which has been described as by Secretary of State Blinken as extremely generous. It's the most generous offer that we've put on the table till now to try and get back those 133 Israeli hostages, men, women, children, baby, being held against their will, a crime against humanity. We're not holding our breath as far as Hamas's response, sadly. We will do our utmost to keep military pressure up on them, because we know that's what's worked in the past. The carrot and the stick, so to speak. Yes. The ability to push them while at the same time working every diplomatic channel that we can.
Well, I find it extraordinary that he says that Hamas is holding babies, because I don't think there's a shred of evidence that they're holding any babies at all. So I don't know where that came from. And of course, what's happening, if you're asking me what I think of what's happening with this ceasefire negotiation, it seems to me that the US and the Israelis are trying to cobble up a supposed offer, which they know Hamas are likely to refuse, so they can then say, well, we've made them an offer, they've refused it, we're now going to kill them all. In the run-up to World War I, the Austro-Hungarian Empire made a similar sort of offer to the Serbs. The Serbs were bending over backwards to try and avoid fighting with the Austro-Hungarian Empire, but the Austro-Hungarians made a proposal to them that they knew they wouldn't accept, so that they could then go to war with them. I would put this so-called ceasefire proposal in that category. In other words, they're only offering not a full-on ceasefire, a pause. And as Netanyahu himself said this week, ceasefire or no ceasefire, we intend to eliminate Hamas, and we're going to fight the war to the end.
I mean,
Hamas would say, we're not going to do a deal with
it. I may be an idiot, but I thought that a ceasefire, the point of that was that though you could then start negotiating about prisoners, hostages, that sort of thing, but you can't really do that whilst still fighting. Isn't that the point of a ceasefire, that negotiations can then begin in earnest?
Well, I think the real sticking point here is that it's not a full-on ceasefire. They're saying, we will give you a pause, and we will swap hostages, and of course, there's a problem of trust. Hamas have made it clear that they're only going to release what they call civilian hostages. I mean, don't forget, the people that they are holding who are military are prisoners of war. They're not hostages, they're prisoners of war. And there's no, you don't exchange those until it's all over.
Anyway, let's carry on with the interview. Mike Graham on Talk TV. Let's also remind listeners about the owner of Talk TV, that is Rupert Murdoch and his company Genie Energy, that he is a shareholder in, which has investments in the Golan Heights, which is part of occupied Syria by the Israelis. Not this time occupied Palestine, but the Israelis kind of like occupying countries around them. So Murdoch has got oil concessions in this part of Syria, which is occupied by Israel. So he's going to obviously put quite a lot of discipline onto his presenters as to what position to take. And of course, Talk TV absolutely deny that there's any genocide going on whatsoever. So let's carry on with this interview with Mike Graham and Avi Hyman this week.
And what about the actual fighting, as it were? Has that kind of still been sort of ratcheted down to some extent? There's been some airstrikes in Rafah. What's going on the front?
Well, fighting continues, actually, in much of Gaza. We've done a fantastic job as far as destroying the vast majority of Hamas. We know that the last four battalions are in Rafah. We need to go after them to destroy Hamas, to break up Hamas, to ensure that they don't have the rule over Gaza anymore and that they can't perpetrate October 7th again. Sadly, we did lose two soldiers yesterday in the fighting. I'll remind you that we're a reservist army, a citizen's army, so these are regular folk that left their jobs and went out to war to defend our nation, because we are under threat of, this is an existential threat. They are trying to destroy us, Iran and all their proxies.
Yes.
Well, I mean, this is people talking to themselves, isn't it? This is hardly yes. a balanced conversation.
Yes, he just says yes. But he's, you know, he's giving him a nice easy ride, a nice super platform there.
Yeah.
But I mean, he's saying, he's talking about the existential threat to Israel. Obviously, Gaza has almost been flattened.
Well, that's right. As you know, I mean, we'd have to go into a big wider discussion of what's really going on and all the rest of it. But I mean, they've tried to delegitimize the existence of Hamas altogether. But at the same time, the first part of the conversation, they're saying, well, we're negotiating with Hamas about this and that and the other. Hang on. You can't negotiate with people. If you're going to negotiate with people, you've recognized them. By negotiating with them, you've recognised them. And don't forget, Hamas won the last democratic election in Palestine in 2006. And all the evidence suggests that their support has actually increased as a result of these, of what's been going on, not decreased. And ultimately, Israel will have to make peace with Hamas or not, in which case the existence of the state of Israel definitely does start to become problematic. The idea that the state of Israel has got a right to exist in its existing borders is simply wrong. The legal position is, if you're in occupation of a territory, the people in that territory have the right to armed resistance to you, but you do not have the right of armed resistance to repress them, because you're the occupiers. You need to withdraw behind the boundary that you were given in, we're talking now about 1967, I would say the boundary you were given in 1948. That's the only legitimate boundary you've got. Everybody who lives outside that boundary is illegitimate.
But before we go back to the interview with Avi Hyman by Mike Graham on Talk TV, the pro-Israel channel, pro-genocide channel, West Yorkshire police officer has admitted terror offences this week over Hamas WhatsApp messages. Calderdale Police Constable Mohammed Adil, 26, shared two images in support of Hamas. West Yorkshire police officers pleaded guilty to two terror offences over messages he shared on WhatsApp in support of Hamas. Calderdale Constable Mohammed Adil shared these images a banned group in the UK of Hamas just weeks after the October the 7th attack in Israel killed 1,200 people. Well, actually, it wasn't the Hamas attack that killed the 1,200 people. Many of those 1,200 people were killed by the Israeli Defence Force, as we now know, by tanks, and even confessions from IDF officers that they were firing tank shells into the Kibbutz Berry, for example. And they saw another 250 being taken hostage. The messages Adil shared on his WhatsApp stories in October and November last year show a Hamas fighter wearing a Hamas headband. Prosecutor Bridget Fitzpatrick told Westminster Magistrates Court yesterday morning, Martin.
Well, Hamas has been a prescribed terrorist organisation in this country, I think, since about 2006.
I mean, it's a relatively recent thing. Yorkshire Live can't, I imagine, put that on their article, because then they would be accused of being a terrorist organisation, showing that picture.
Well, if you remember back in the day, the Margaret Thatcher...
The guy isn't apparently doing anything. He's just there. He's just stood there with a Hamas headband.
Yes, and that what they're saying is anybody who expresses any kind of sympathy for Hamas is giving the oxygen of publicity to the terrorists. And if you remember how that worked out in Ireland, the IRA remained a banned organisation, and it met for many years, of course, you weren't allowed to fly the Irish tricolour in the six counties. It was illegal. And in Britain, we've decided, the government's decided, that Hamas and Hezbollah are both terrorist organisations. Anybody who shows any support for them is a terrorist. But both Hamas and Hezbollah are legal political parties in their own terms.
Poor old Yorkshire Post aren't really allowed to say much about this, it seems. Otherwise, they'll be accused of being terrorists. Just a minute. The image on the 4th of November that this policeman has admitted to posting had a message on it saying, "We will hold accountable all those who occupied our lands, and Allah will hold accountable all those who remained silent against this occupation and oppression."
Which, as far as I'm concerned, is a legitimate expression of political opinion. And police officers are allowed to have political opinions as long as it doesn't affect their professional behaviour.
Isn't this something effectively the International Criminal Court in The Hague are saying?
It is. But, of course, what's happening here is anybody who says anything, the whole ideology that we're being dominated by, including Keir Starmer and the Labour Party, is that Hamas are illegitimate. Now, some of the things they did on October the 7th are pretty unpleasant, but they're nothing like as unpleasant as what subsequently occurred. And in any case, don't forget, the main fault that the Hamas have committed here is by killing civilians and taking civilian hostages. They've got every right under international law to kill Israeli soldiers and police officers and anybody else who holds a gun. And don't forget that all of the areas around Gaza are the villages where the people from Gaza used to live, which have been occupied by kibbutzes and other Israeli settlements. Now, those settlements are as illegitimate, in my view, as the settlements in the West Bank. I don't see at this stage of the game why anybody's talking about the 1967 borders of Israel as about the negotiation. They need to get back inside the 1948 borders, or we might just decide to stop recognising the state of Israel altogether.
In fact,
some states are no longer existent.
The opinion
Artsakh has been wiped out in Nagorno-Karabakh in Azerbaijan. That's happened. It's gone.
In the opinion of Philippa Winkler, who's a Jewish lecturer at the LSE, who joined us a couple of months ago to discuss all this, over Easter, I think it was, she said exactly what is being said on his WhatsApp. And this guy's apparently a terrorist. So why isn't Philippa a terrorist?
Well, she was very careful about saying about how she spoke.
Why aren't we terrorists?
Well,
this is a bizarre legislation whereby supporting Hamas can be construed as you're a terrorist. Well, actually, Hamas, surely, the Palestinians have a legitimate right to self-defence, don't they?
I would argue that they
have,
Tony. And
they've elected Hamas.
They elected Hamas in 2006.
This is all very peculiar.
Right. It is very peculiar.
Even they've elected these people, Hamas, and even though Hamas are somehow proscribed as a terrorist group, so why isn't the Israeli Defense Force for killing 40,000 civilians, why aren't they proscribed as a terrorist group?
Well, let's think about the Irgun and the Haganah who created the State of Israel by killing thousands of civilians and killing British soldiers and police officers. Are they terrorists? Are they terrorists? No, they are. I would say
a bit arbitrary about the way that these groups appear on this terrorist list,
well,
isn't it?
It is. It's totally arbitrary. I would argue if you're
the Order of the Nine Angles is not on their list, is it?
Well, I would also.
This is a far right terrorist group that encourages people to commit murder.
Yes, and the State of Israel was created by people who acted absolutely in exactly the same way as Hamas are doing. What Hamas are doing is giving back to the Israelis what was dished out to them. They are killing, it was a very successful operation in many ways. It shocked the Israelis, their economies in free fall. And of course, ultimately, there could be a world war over this. And at the end of that world war, Israel, a country the size of Wales, may no longer exist.
I'd love to know who decides who's going to go on the terrorist list, why it is that the Palestinians, the 2 million or so of them in Gaza, have apparently no right to self-defence, according to the British law.
Well, it's just basically, it's not do as we do, it's do as we say, isn't it?
I'm not sure any of this has been actually voted by our elected representatives. This is just a decision made by MI5, the Home Office,
right,
and the security services,
right,
about which, by the way, folks, we'll be hearing a bit more next week.
Yes, well, I mean, it's totally, I mean, just to say that Hamas is a legitimate political force, is just stating the obvious. And if you're going to accuse me of being a Hamas supporter for saying that, I wouldn't vote for Hamas. I'm not Palestinian. I don't get a vote in Palestinian elections.
If you were Palestinian, would you vote for Hamas?
I probably would. I probably would. And of course, if you're in a situation, you're going to vote for who you're going to vote for. I mean, I wouldn't have voted for Churchill, but I'd probably have supported him in World War II when it came down to it. And what he said is, we will fight our enemies on the beaches. We'll fight them on the streets of our cities. We'll fight them in the mountains and the hills. We will never surrender. That is Hamas's position. Because they're under attack. Mm. We're not going to lie down, we're going to fight.
I mean, the point is, in many ways, the position of the Palestinians is, as an occupied country, is far better in legal terms than the Israelis. Anyway, let's go Indeed. Back to Avi Hyman, this wonderful guy chatting on Talk TV, and see what you make of this next clip, Martin.
And of course, you know, the Blinken sort of situation is interesting, isn't it? Because the White House is playing what I would say is a quite complicated role, because Blinken, while continuing to give support to Israel and continuing to give military support to Israel, is making some odd statements, you might say, for somebody who's meant to be a friend of Israel. They came out overnight on the BBC to say that the US had accused Israeli forces of war crimes, effectively, or violating human rights, but in various different situations some time ago. You know, I'm not quite sure what the point of that would be.
So I'm not going to comment on things coming out. I don't know what the Americans meant by that. What I do know is that Rear Admiral retired Rear Admiral John Kirby at the White House himself said categorically that Israel has not crossed the line of international law, has not broken international law in any way to the best of their knowledge. Lord Cameron said something very similar. We are committed to international law. We are committed to going after Hamas, those brutal terrorists that killed 1,200 of our people, raped, beheaded, burned whole families alive. We have to do it, not just for Israel, but for the entire world.
Well, they're repeating there things that have been proved to be wrong. Nobody was raped, although in actual fact there is evidence piling up now that the Israeli Defense Forces have been carrying out rapes in their detention camps. There were no babies killed apart from one small child, which was probably killed by the Israeli Defense Forces. And, they just keep this propaganda stuff going. Now, that is not independent, balanced journalism. Obviously, we've got a partisan role here. You know, we're clearly on one side rather than another. But that's
the side of human rights, and international law.
Yes, and also, but we are listening to what they're saying and critiquing it, but they're not listening to us at all, are they? They're not interested in what we've got to say. They just talk to themselves. And of course, the problem is for them is that in the vast majority of the world where most people live, they just don't buy into it.
And so, in terms of this particular ceasefire arrangement, is there a time limit on when Hamas can accept it by, or at what point does it get withdrawn?
So let me just push back on the word ceasefire. A ceasefire is what a lot of people were shouting for in the streets of London. It's what Hamas definitely wants. Hamas wants to end the war because Hamas wants to stay in power. Hamas, as they've said, wants to perpetrate October 7th again and again and again. What we've got at the table at the moment is a pause in the fighting to ensure that we can get the 133 hostages home. What we've said from day one, is that if Hamas would just unequivocally surrender, put their hands in the air, wave a white flag, and give back those 133 stolen Israelis, then we would have a deal because Hamas would be taken down. Our objectives remain the same, to destroy Hamas, to bring home the hostages, and to ensure that Gaza doesn't pose a threat to Israel anymore. That's what we'll do. If it takes a short time at the negotiation table to get the hostages back, we will plow on with our mission to destroy Hamas because we can't live with that threat on our border.
Avi, thank you very much indeed. Good to talk to you. Avi Hyman there, Israeli government spokesman, pushing ahead with what they call a pause in the fighting to get those hostages back.
So in other words, they're not offering a ceasefire at all. They're saying if Hamas surrenders, then we will have won and then there'll be a ceasefire because we will have won. I can see why Hamas do not want to accept that. They want a permanent ceasefire, withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza, and then a prisoner swap. This whole presentation of this as Hamas refusing a ceasefire, Netanyahu himself this week said, whatever deal is done, we're still going to destroy Hamas. And Hamas might rightly say, well, whatever deal we're doing, and we're not necessarily doing a deal with you because you're not agreement capable, we intend to destroy you. And we don't mean the Israeli people. The people aren't necessarily the problem. The problem is the Israeli state and the extent of the Israeli state. In the 1990s, Britain and other NATO countries went to war with Serbia for doing far less in Kosovo than the Israelis have done now in Gaza. Far less. And we had a 78-day bombing campaign, which killed hundreds of civilians, destroyed infrastructure. The Israelis are an illegitimate state, and it's increasingly becoming clear to people across Africa, for example, you are just an illegitimate state.
Rogue state, maybe.
A rogue state.
Eliakim Liebman, remains of a man thought to have been a Hamas hostage, has been found in Israel. This is the BBC this afternoon. One of the hostages thought to have been abducted by Hamas on the 7th of October has been declared dead after his body was found in Israel. The Israeli Defense Forces have confirmed. They haven't said exactly where it was found. Maybe in a morgue somewhere. The IDF said Eliakim Liebman's remains were identified through a thorough and complex investigation. He was working as a security guard at the Nova Festival at the time of the attack. His family said he stayed behind for hours treating other wounded people. In its statement, the IDF said on Friday the National Institute of Forensic Medicine, the Ministry of Health, had notified Liebman's family that he was murdered in the October the 7th massacre led by Hamas. Well, he could have been one of those people killed by the helicopter gunships that the Israeli Defense Forces sent into the Nova Festival, potentially, but they haven't mentioned that here on the BBC. This is looking about 1,200 people apparently were killed during the 7th of October attacks. More than 360 of those killed were attending this festival. Around about 130 hostages from more than 250 kidnapped by Hamas during its attack remain unaccounted for. At least 34 of them are presumed dead. So they remain accounted for 130. So if we're talking here about 35 of these hostages Israel so-called wants back. Well, they do want them back, but they seem to be killing them at a slow rate. And this one particular one has turned up in Israel, but most of them seem to be being killed over in Gaza.
Many of them have been killed by the indiscriminate bombing. As Hamas have pointed out, we're treating them well. When Hamas takes hostages, and they have taken hostages in the past, they tend to treat them well because they're useful bargaining chips. So you don't be nasty to them. If anybody's going to be fed, you're going to be fed. But a lot of them have been killed by the indiscriminate bombing. I think it's quite clear to the families of the hostages in Israel that the government doesn't care about the hostages. They're using this whole situation as a heaven-sent opportunity to destroy Hamas as they see it, and also to ethnically cleanse the Palestinian problem. A final solution to the Palestinian problem is what they see it as. And we've had that guy Jonathan Pollard, who was the spy that gave all the nuclear secrets of the US to Israel and was put in prison for it and then released. He was saying that the hostages' families should just shut up. Do you remember we had a quote from him? They should just shut up because we don't want to hear from them, because we are now going to war to destroy the Palestinians, and if their families are just collateral roadkill. That's the attitude of the Israeli government towards the hostages, their own hostages, let alone their attitude towards the Palestinian civilian population.
A bit of fun, Martin, now. We're going to let you choose. President Biden has done the speech to the White House correspondence dinner this week, which is, these press people that turn up that Donald Trump used to go, "Hey, you fake news." These people have a nice big dinner every year, and the president will give a little talk to them. So he kind of slows down as the talk goes on. I think it's around about half an hour altogether. He starts off all sort of fired up, and he sort of winds down bit by bit towards the end. So it's really up to you. Would you like to hear him all fired up at the beginning, or would you like to hear him sort of winding down in his kind of attempted crescendo at the last minute? It's up to you, Martin.
Well, let's have the attempted crescendo. That's probably, much more amusing.
Have a listen to this.
I said the most urgent question of our time is whether democracy is still the sacred cause of America. That is the question the American people must answer this year. And you, the Pre-Press, play a critical role in making sure the American people have the information they need to make an informed decision. A defeated former president has made no secret of his attack on our democracy. He said he wants to be a dictator on day one, and so much more. He tells supporters he is their revenge and retribution. When in God's name have you heard of another president say something like that? And he promised a bloodbath when he loses again. We have to take this seriously. 8 years ago,
You could have written off it as just Trump talk, but no longer, not after January 6th. I'm sincerely not asking of you to take sides, but asking you to rise up to the seriousness of the moment. Move past the horse race numbers and the gotcha moments and the distractions, the sideshows that have come to dominate and sensationalize our politics. And focus on what's actually at stake. And I think in your hearts you know it was at stake. The stakes couldn't be higher. Every single one of us has a role to play, a serious role to play, in making sure democracy endures, American democracy. I have more my role, but in all due respect, so do you. In the age of disinformation, credible information that people can trust is more important than ever. And that makes you, and I mean this from the bottom of my heart, makes you more important than ever. So tonight, I'd like to make a toast. To a free press, to an informed citizenry, to an America where freedom and democracy endure, God bless America. Now, I'm going to turn it over to Kelly, then you'll hear from a real comedian.
Well, it's just...
Yeah, because he was a little bit slow, you know, by that time he's wound down a little bit. But then he's saying a real comedian, so he's thinking it's the God Bless America thing is some sort of comedy.
Well, it's an attempt at levity, isn't it? But at the same time...
Not a very good one.
No, pathetic. And, of course, the anti... I mean, Trump is, is a barbarian, but then so is Biden. This is the problem. The rigged system in the US doesn't give the possibility of having a serious discussion about anything because both sides are mired in lies, deceit, and narcissism. And that's true of the whole society, I'm afraid, just like the Israeli society.
Okay, so the press, since we're talking about the press, I don't know if people noticed, like, people watch ITV News, and I just happened to tune in 11 last Friday to check out ITV News and found that it wasn't there. And this was because the news presenter, Raggy Omar, had a bit of a sort of session when he was reading the news. He kept getting it all wrong. And we're going to have a listen to that now. But bear in mind what is going on here. So the guy's turned up to work. He's not feeling very good. He's looking a bit woozy. He's feeling woozy. And the producer of ITV News at ITN would be looking, saying, well, hang on, Raggy, you know, you're not really fit to read the news. And Raggy's saying, yes, I am, yes, I am. So this is about the power of these newscasters, which are effectively what Dennis Potter called glorified bus conductors. The producer can say yes or no as to whether someone is fit to read a news bulletin. And that, I would imagine, is what's going on behind the scenes. There's been all sorts of reports saying, oh, is it, you know, Raggy's okay, thank you everyone for... But why was he reading the news if he's not fit to read it? It's because he is pushing back against the ITM people who produce and, you know, that make the programme, wrongly. But anyway, let's have a listen now and see what you make of Raggy Omar trying to present the news when he wasn't well last Friday night.
Good evening. It's little wonder that King Charles is said to be greatly encouraged by today's announcement of his return to royal duties. So far, this has been a tough year for him and the royal family. Both he and Princess of Wales were diagnosed with cancer. A few brief glimpses aside, the King has been out of the spotlight since early February when the began receiving outpatient care for his still undiagnosed cancer. But after doctors said they were both pleased and encouraged by his progress, the King will next week start returning to public-facing role. It will, however, be a carefully calibrated comeback. And finally, for decades, Friday night has been party night, but when people start letting their hair down at the close of the morning week, the weekends are Britain's towns and cities have traditionally been all about nightlife, pubs and clubs packed to the rafters with revelers. But that seems to be changing along with people's priorities as they choose to do things different at different times.
John Ray, News at 10.
And that's it for tonight. Thank you and have a great weekend.
So, yeah, so there's Raggy Omar trying to present the news. But, you know, you can imagine the tussle going on behind the scenes with, you know, the producer, the director saying, Raggy, you know, you're not well. Let someone else do it. And him sort of toughing it out. Not very professional, unfortunately. So I think it's one of the things that it says to me is the power dynamics going on in our TV and radio newsrooms these days. It doesn't seem very professional to let a guy who's actually sick to carry on and do a bulletin. Like, actually, pretty much anybody who's had some sort of news experience who is there, a standby of some sort, could have come in and just read the auto cue because Raggy couldn't.
Well, I think he did a better job than Biden.
Yes, that's true.
I'm afraid so.
Yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely right. Anyway, somebody who has been kicked out, even though they've done an extremely good job, is a lady called Sangeeta Miska. She's from LBC, and here is the final interview she did. She's been booted off LBC now to be replaced by somebody who's more Israeli-friendly. And here she is talking to an Israeli spokesperson. That to begin with, here she's talking about, Martin, this important business of the Iranian drone attack and missile attack on Israel after the Israelis struck the Damascus consulate of Iran and killed I think it was seven altogether, two generals of the Iranian army and a whole bunch of other people in the Iranian forces over in Syria. So they're just sort of saying, well, we don't care if it's Syria, we're just going to kill you anyway. And obviously this is an act of war, and so this is the reason why the Iranians decided to do their retaliatory attack with drones and missiles against Israel, in which nobody, by the way, was killed. But anyway, so this is the interview that that took place on LBC. Doing the interviewing is Sangeeta Miska. I think it was literally the day after this happened.
Sangeeta, there's already been a direct direct conflict vis-a-vis the Houthis, and that is ongoing. Iran stands behind this. It is their interest to engulf the area. We never wanted that. We didn't choose this war. We didn't want this war. But we have to defend ourselves. I mean, can you imagine if they had nuclear weapons? That's the real question.
With all due respect, that's not the real question. What the Iranians, of course, have said is that this is a retaliatory strike after Israel struck its consulate in Syria. Now, we all know that the way diplomacy works is consulates and embassies are considered sovereign territory of the government that is concerned. What Israel did by taking that action against Iran was escalate what is already an incredibly fragile situation.
Sangeeta, that's an outrageous framing of the reality.
It's not outrageous framing. I've been speaking to somebody who is a diplomat to Iran from the UK government. That's not an outrageous framing of it. What Israel did was strike what is considered in diplomatic circles the sovereign territory of Iran, whether we like it or not. No. And there was undoubtedly going to be a blowback. So did Israel game out what was going to happen next?
Firstly, I'm not going to speak directly to that strike. What I can say definitively, and this is why it's outrageous, I can say definitively is that that wasn't an embassy, it wasn't a consulate, it wasn't any type of diplomatic mission.
That's what Iran says.
So would you like to copy and paste?
Are you suggesting every single news organization in the world has got that wrong?
No, I'm suggesting that the Iranians have an interest to say that that was a diplomatic mission when we know definitively it wasn't. Okay, because they then want to give you the response that you've just copied and pasted, with all due respect. So I can tell you that I can't speak directly to the strike, but I can say that definitively that was an Al-Quds military base being used by forces of the Iranian regime, and they were bent on Israel's destruction. They were working towards Israel's destruction. They were working actively with their proxies.
So that's Sangeeta Miska, now sacked from LBC. She's chatting, Martin, to the very same chap we were just hearing, Avi Hyman. And then because she's upset him, it looks like she's been sacked and been replaced by Vanessa Phelps.
Well, we can see which way the wind's blowing here. Even the Israeli guy is not going to admit, if you kill several top generals of another country's military, that is definitely an act of war. and they're going to retaliate, aren't they? If somebody killed, you know, let's say the Houthis managed to kill some of our top generals, would we regard that as an act of war? I think we probably would, wouldn't we? We shouldn't be at war with Yemen, by the way. We've just stumbled into that to keep the Israelis happy and the Americans. That's outrageous, really. It's the poorest country in the Middle East. We've been bombing it indirectly through our Saudi proxies for the last 10 years, and it's the worst humanitarian tragedy in the world.
What do you make of this tussle they're having there about, I mean, for example, he's saying he didn't want to talk about the attack the day after, but she's saying, well, actually, most of the world is saying that you, Israelis, did that, and that is a violation of international law and their sovereign territory, and, of course, the answer to it all was the Iranian drone attack. So, you know, it's a legitimate question to be asking. It seems that she's been sacked for it. But that was a really good interview, which I'll put up on our show page, bless her, thisweek.org.uk. You know, been there, Sangeeta, got the T-shirt. But this is where discussion she had with Avi Hyman, just, you know, the same guy as we heard earlier, just a few seconds after that chat there. She was talking to him about this whole idea of a ceasefire.
There will be a meeting of the G7 later on today. We know that the UN Security Council will also meet. Undoubtedly, as part of diplomatic utterances, we will undoubtedly see many countries coming out in support of Israel, but we will also probably see renewed calls for a ceasefire in Gaza. We know that Biden's language has been changing, particularly since those seven international aid workers were killed. Initially, he was saying the ceasefire is all down to Hamas, and we know, don't we, that he's now putting pressure on Israel and saying, actually, you have to also meet halfway. What are the chances of a ceasefire?
We said from day one that this war could end today if Hamas put their hands up, surrendered, and gave back the 133 stolen Israelis, men, women, and children. That could happen. But Hamas has rejected, just a few days ago, has rejected our latest offer as far as a deal. If you're talking about some kind of a ceasefire without the hostages, what, you want us to leave our people in Gaza that are being raped, that are being abused, that aren't being fed properly, that to be left under Hamas? And to allow Hamas to retake Gaza?
Well,
and to
I don't think. Mr. Hyman, if you've been listening to this program, nobody is suggesting any of those things. What I'm asking you is, will Israel renew its efforts to create a ceasefire, which at this point the entire international community wants? And the reason, and not only the international community, you two know what the ICJ ruling is, which is that there is a plausible case of genocide to answer. There is growing international pressure on Israel to reach some kind of a ceasefire, even if it is the thing that Biden has just outlined, which is a 6 to 8 week ceasefire, in which, in his words, he wants all food aid, all medical aid allowed into Gaza as a starting point for a permanent ceasefire. Why doesn't Netanyahu and his government come closer to meeting that?
We have put the most forward-thinking proposal on the table. Hamas has rejected it. What you said about international law, I'll reject that personally, in the words of John Kirby from the White House, who said that we have not transgressed any international law. We've not violated international
law. I didn't say you had. I said the ICJ says there is a plausible case to answer when it comes to genocide. I'm very careful with my words, Mr. Right. Hyman, so please respect that. Will Israel come closer now under huge international pressure to get to a ceasefire position? Because the instability that we have seen, of course, began with Hamas and its terrorist attack on Israel. But what has happened since then has caused huge international outrage. That is undeniable. What is Israel going to do to come closer to a ceasefire?
Again, I would like to see pressure put on Hamas. We could end this war today if they surrendered and gave back the hostages. It's that simple. But they're not doing that because they want to stay in power.
Well, they say they will only do that in response to a permanent ceasefire.
Well, that would mean that they would be in power of the Gaza Strip. Our objective in this war from day one has been to destroy Hamas, to bring home the hostages, and to ensure that Gaza is not a threat to us. Gaza would be a threat to us, Hamas would be in power, and we wouldn't get the hostages back. So that wouldn't make any sense.
Avi Hyman, spokesperson for the Israeli government. Thank you very much indeed for making time this afternoon. Much appreciated.
Well, I mean, the fundamental issue here has always been the idea that Hamas could simply be delegitimized as a, you know, we're within our rights to destroy Hamas because Hamas is a threat to us, even if they're the elected government of Palestine. And I would compare Hamas to the Israeli government itself. They are both violent entities which have tried to put their will on the other side through violence, including the killing of civilians. In actual fact, you know, I abhor the killing of all civilians by anybody. But let's face it, the state of Israel itself was created by the Nakba, which was a massive massacre of Palestinians, and hundreds of thousands and millions of them were driven from their homes. That was how the state of Israel was created. Not one of those people who did that were put on trial or punished or got rid of. The creation of the state of Israel was absolutely illegitimate. And all Hamas are doing is giving back to the Israelis exactly what they dished out to them. Now, that's very regrettable, undoubtedly, from a human point of view, but the idea that you can just make the other side disappear is wrong. Hamas are not going to be able to abolish the state of Israel through violence, and the Israelis are not going to abolish Hamas through violence either.
Okay, so
both sides have got a legitimate right to their
cause. One of the things Avi Hyman's talking about there, I mean, this is, and I'll put, like I said, a version of the full version of the Sangeeta Misca final interview on LBC, which she's been booted out from, it seems. I mean, the LBC don't confirm this, but it's pretty obvious that some sort of complaint and strings have been pulled, and somebody at LBC has said she's got to go. You know, Assad has got to go, Gaddafi has got to go, Putin's got to go, and Sangeeta Misca has got to go. So this is just like mafia bullying, basically. I'll put the full version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. He's rather cheekily says, oh, well, the Iranians could have nuclear weapons. Maybe they've got nuclear weapons. If they had nuclear weapons. Of course, he has got nuclear weapons. The Israelis do have nuclear weapons. And the main point here is that nukes are potentially, I mean, I've said this many times, Roger Cook, back in the 1990s, did a program where he was actually offered weapons-grade plutonium over in Russia. In the 1990s, the army hadn't been paid, and the black market was rife, and he took the initiative on himself as part of the program, the Cook Report, which got destroyed by Rupert Murdoch's News of the World, by the way, around about 2000, in a complete smear campaign over several weeks, killing off Roger's program. Is that these nuclear weapons in the 90s, Russian ones, were available on the black market, Martin?
Well, I believe it was...
Well, weapons-grade plutonium, at the least.
Yes, and I don't think it was necessarily Russia. It was actually in Ukraine.
Could well have been, indeed. Yes.
The Iranians... could develop nuclear weapons. They've clearly got...
Well, they maybe got an SS-20. I mean, this is one of the points here. An SS-20 is a very powerful nuclear weapon. I'm just trying...
It's a missile rather than a nuclear weapon.
Yeah, that's right. It's a nuclear weapon. It is a nuclear weapon. If I fire one at you, you sure know about it, mate.
Yeah, but what the Iranians and the Russians have now got is far better missiles than the SS-20.
It's a 1970s one. Apparently.
Exactly. The SS-20 is an old piece of kit.
And Scott Ritter was one of the people that got it scrapped. But they still had some around.
Well, yeah, no, but the point is that the missile itself is not the issue. It's the warhead, isn't it? The Israelis...
Would you like to know how big the warhead is? It's either three warheads of about 200 kilotons or one megaton warhead with a range of, would you like to guess? 3,000 miles.
Yeah.
It's on a mobile launcher, very much like the cruise missiles.
But I mean, the current 1980s.
The
current missiles that are being deployed in all of these conflicts are far superior than the boring old SS-20.
Yeah, but still, it's rather useful for a country to have one of those. And my point is, in the 1990s, Roger Cook was offered one. Anyway, the program, when I originally interviewed Roger, must be about 8-10 years ago now, at his home, in retirement, he explained that all these programs have been lost because of a fire at Carlton Television. But they've been found, many of them. It's nice to see that you can actually watch this program, Dirty Bomb, on YouTube. And I'll put a link up to this and the full version of this program on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. So here's Roger Cook over in Russia. And you also hear the voice of the British nuclear engineer, John Large, who what they did is they actually built a suitcase bomb. The idea is to see if they could smuggle it here, there and everywhere to make the point that actually a lot of this nuclear bomb technology, whether it's an actual hydrogen bomb or uranium bomb like the Hiroshima bomb, you can smuggle it around in a very small size. And also, of course, even if it doesn't actually go off as a nuclear bomb, it could be a dirty bomb where the explosives will scatter all this high-level radiation over a large area. So let's have a listen to a clip from that now. And he mentions this SS-20 that he's offered by this Russian Gennady.
Next stop, the Atomic Energy Ministry in Moscow.
What control the plutonium?
All these materials, like plutonium, are under strict control. I'm shocked, and I am surprised. It's particularly important with plutonium that it cannot possibly fall into the wrong hands, into the hands of dishonest people who might make weapons of it.
But I must make it clear, the precautions haven't worked because we have been offered this stuff, and these are analysis of actual samples. It's out of the system. It was offered to us. We could buy it if we wanted to.
What can I say? We must look at this and check all the channels again and again so that such a thing does not happen again.
But it had happened. We promised him more details and returned to Gennady's flat in a Moscow suburb. We didn't have the £200 million with us, but we did have the plans Gennady wanted. A design for the special transit containers to carry the Cook Report plutonium out of Russia.
Looking for Gennady. Gennady, how do you do? I bring you the drawing.
To get our plutonium out, Gennady suggested his tried and trusted route via Vilnius in Lithuania.
Okay, so what size is that?
Gennady then said he could supply a proper container of his own if we took all the plutonium in one large shipment. He gave us his real name, Gennady Semenov, and his account number for payment at a bank in Finland. Before we left, there was one last surprise.
Would you be interested in plutonium in the form of warhead?
SS-20.
The SS-20 is a ballistic missile.
And
SS-47. I should think so.
As he said, why buy the materials to make a weapon when he could sell us one complete?
And where are they available to see?
But he did have a uranium-plutonium mix under the stairs. He brought it out in its lead container in a plastic shopping bag. And as Gennady concluded, he could keep the supply going as long as we could keep the money going.
Yeah, we're going to make some calls. We will, it's very heavy.
There was more to tell the man from the Ministry of Atomic Energy, and he'd volunteered to give us a progress report.
What have you discovered since you've had the paperwork properly looked at by your scientists?
We're working on this. We are trying to find out where the material really could have come from. If the material described as containing plutonium is really of such composition, it is very dangerous. Plutonium of the 240 range is an extremely active neutron reactant.
So, Doctor, thank you very much.
And so, all it needed was the money, and £200 million worth of weapons-grade plutonium could have gone to terrorists in the West.
He would then, near to the site, plug in the various electronics. This one here. Put this one in, which is very difficult to do, but I'll stick it in there. Put it on the site. Set a timer on this, or whatever device he wants to use. And the final thing, plug in the battery, like this.
So John Large there finishing that clip from Roger Cook's Cook Report, Dirty Bomb. Plug in the battery, Martin, and walk away. Now, Russia was in a bit of a state in the 1990s, and all the tests proved positive. Obviously, they didn't buy the plutonium, weapons-grade plutonium from this guy, but the test sample the guy gave him proved positive. And actually, eventually, he was arrested by the Russians' atomic energy authorities that Cook had also been chit-chatting with.
Well, in other words, that what was happening in the 90s in the former Soviet Union was because of the policies pursued by the West, people, the economy was being destroyed, and therefore people were finding ways to make a living in the chaos, what they call bespredel, the no rules years. I was in Vilnius in that period, and I was threatened by the mafia there. And the main
Do you have any plutonium come
no,
to you?
No, I'm just talking about other things. I was more low level than that, actually. The mafia were mainly involved in intimidating farmers in order to rob them of their profits in selling their food. And also, of course, there was another big aspect, because Vilnius is the entrepot to the former Soviet bloc. They were one of the biggest exporters of metals for many years, even though they've got no metal, you know, they've got no iron ore, nothing. And that was because the whole of Russia proper was being totted out by the mafia, and it was all being exported with no licenses or anything, and no taxes paid via Vilnius. And the Baltic states were being used by the mafia as a mechanism for looting the Russia proper, and then taking the profits in the Baltic states, and so on. But of course, eventually this was all closed down by the official authorities in Russia.
So, no, the obvious question here, which nobody ever asked, apart from me, it seems, is if Roger Cook can get an SS-20, surely the Iranians could. And many other countries. I mean, these intelligence services aren't stupid.
Yeah.
If they know, if they even think that maybe some of this equipment is available on the black market, they're going to go and buy it, aren't they?
Yeah, but the other thing I'd have to mention in this context is that dirty bombs, even the Americans admitted this themselves, dirty bombs will freak people out, but in terms of real danger, they're not that dangerous.
But this isn't a dirty bomb, Martin. This is an SS-20
yes.
with 3,000 mile warheads, each of 150 kilotons,
yes.
or one warhead
how
of one megaton.
How are they going to smuggle that out of Russia?
Well, they might smuggle it on a ship.
I suppose so. And it's quite possible that the Iranians could, by doing these methods, or
it's not just Iran, is it? I mean, it could almost be the Solomon Islands, or almost anybody that thought that they might be in North Korea, people like this.
It's virtually certain, if we carry on down the road of nuclear proliferation and brinkmanship, that nuclear weapons will be used by somebody sooner or later, probably sooner. We all know that.
In the moment that the United States exploded the first atomic bomb in Hiroshima back in 1945, surely this was inevitable, really.
It's once we've done that, once we've crossed...
They said, thank God, this weapon has come forward to us.
Yes, I mean, once you've crossed that... I mean, as Einstein famously said, if I'd known what would have happened, I would have been a locksmith. That's what he said. But once you've got nuclear weapons, you've then got to deal with the consequences.
I'm not sure Einstein really was necessary to the creation of the atomic bomb, was it?
No,
I don't think so.
Yeah, well, I think his theories were underpinned it. Yeah, that's what he was saying. And of course, he was the one who went to Roosevelt and said, I have to tell you, sir, that there is a possibility that a weapon could be developed like this. And that's what the Manhattan Project was set up. I mean, this is what the film Oppenheimer is all about.
And we'll be having some stuff about Farm Hall, by the way, next week, which is the place in Lincolnshire, I think it was. Lincolnshire. Where the German scientists were taken, and the place was completely bugged, so the British could listen to what these German nuclear scientists was saying at the end of the Second World War. But really, I mustn't get too diverted from Gaza, even though, Hyman has, sort of talking about nuclear weapons of Iran, when he has them himself. Do you think the Iranians, could have either developed or bought on the black market nuclear weapons?
They could easily
be a bit stupid not to, maybe.
They could easily do so. They've chosen not to do so for two reasons. One, there's a fatwa against such weaponry, and B, they don't need nuclear weapons from a military point
of
view.
Hang on, they have just announced, this is a couple of weeks ago, that they're going to reconsider this fatwa.
Well, indeed, because they're being put under pressure. But in actual fact, they don't need nuclear weapons in order to threaten Israel. The attack that they carried out the other week was a warning strike. If they decided to fire their missiles, it's the missile technology which is the key to this. The missiles are far more accurate than the SS-20. They can hit exactly what they fire them at, and they can't be stopped. So if they wanted to, they could take out all of the infrastructure. And the other thing, they could create a nuclear attack on Dimona, which is the Israeli nuclear power station, and that would be a dirty bomb. It wouldn't be a nuclear explosion, but it would be like Chernobyl, and it would cover the whole area with radioactivity.
I wonder when the Greens...
But they're unusable, because don't forget the Palestinian population lives in Palestine, which they call Israel.
Well, they're not unusable, are they?
Well, they are unusable if you don't want to kill the Palestinians.
Well, what if you don't care?
Well, if you don't care, you don't care, but the Iranians do care.
And one of the Israeli cabinet ministers threatened, he said, oh, well, we could just nuke Gaza. I mean, they're just being silly.
But that's idiotic, because if he does that, then the whole of Israel would be contaminated.
Apparently there's DU contamination in Gaza anyway.
Well, yes, then we've heard about that, because Chris Busby was explaining all about it. The nuclear weapons, you know, once you start talking about using nuclear weapons, you're in Dr. Strangelove territory.
It's not DU, it's enriched uranium. Yeah, I mean, but can we just move on, because we're getting towards the end?
Yeah.
The Greens are almost certainly going to be announced as running Bristol City Council tomorrow, when they have this count, which is God knows who's been interfering with those ballot boxes while they've been sitting around doing nothing, who's had access to them, who's been taking their rubbers out and rubbing out people.
I think that's
votes.
Unlikely.
But it's allowing. It's a possibility, isn't it? I mean,
it's
why
a logical possibility, but yeah. It's not very likely.
It isn't very likely. Fingers crossed, on the elections. Yeah, because they are anyway. No one cares about elections anyway now, really, do they? Because the New World Order runs things. So who cares about? And you've got both parties pretty much the same. As
well, no,
hearing.
But the Greens aren't both parties, are they?
Anyway,
it'll be a breakthrough for them if they win.
The Greens will do quite well here, and it's nice to hear Caroline Lucas, the outgoing Green MP, saying this at Prime Minister's Questions this week.
Caroline Lucas.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. In February, his foreign secretary said it would be difficult for a ground offensive on Rafah to avoid harming civilians and destroying homes. Just yesterday, his deputy foreign secretary admitted he was struggling to see how such an attack could be compliant with international humanitarian law. All the signs are that Netanyahu is about to defy the international community. An attack on the 1.5 million Palestinians sheltering in Rafah is imminent. If that attack begins, will that be the moment when the Prime Minister finally finds the moral backbone to ban arms exports to Israel? And if not, how much more suffering has to happen before he acts to prevent further UK complicity in crimes against humanity?
Well, Mr. Speaker, what the Honourable Lady did not acknowledge at all is that Israel suffered an appalling terrorist attack that kills hundreds of its citizens, and it does have the right to defend itself. Now, of course, as I've been crystal clear, we want to see humanitarian law respected and adhered to by all parties. Too many civilians have been killed, and we do want to see Israel take greater care to avoid harming civilians. I've made these points repeatedly to Prime Minister Netanyahu, specifically about the impacts of any military incursion into Rafah, and we continue to say to the Israelis at all levels that we want to see more aid going in and bring about a hostage deal so we can move towards a sustainable ceasefire.
Well, I think one of the reasons why the Greens are going to take Bristol City Council tomorrow, if they do, is that it's quite clear that the Muslim community in Bristol, which was very loyal to the Labour Party, have turned their coats. And it's precisely because of things like that. Because the Greens, whatever their failures on that we were talking about at the beginning of the show, they are at least clear about that. And I think that they are exposing Keir Starmer and Rishi Sunak as génocidaires.
What?
Génocidaires. It's French, Tony. It means people who are complicit in genocide.
Well, Green Party responds to ill-judged and offensive alleged anti-Semitic post by candidate. That's in Bristol Live this week on Wednesday. Bristol's Green Party has responded to an ill-judged and offensive anti-Semitic social media post. The party was contacted by Lord Mann, the government's anti-Semitism advisor, over posts in October involving Bristol candidate Mohammed Makawi. who used to have the show just after us on BCFM, didn't he? And he's now a Green councillor, which showed part of a Hamas press conference. Another made false claims about the killing of Israeli citizens. Well, that's maybe by the IDF, which we think is most probably true. The Post followed the Hamas attack on October the 7th. The Green Party said Mr. Makawi had apologised, undertaken social media training, while Mr. Malik was unwittingly implicated by being tagged in the Post. Spokesman added, "We have responded to Lord Mann with evidence of the actions we have taken to remove these ill-judged and offensive communications."
Well, I'd be very interested to know exactly what Mohammed said there, because I've been seeing him on these demonstrations that we've been having. Can I mention that there is a demonstration tomorrow in Bristol, which will assemble at 12 p.m. on the downs by the water towers, by the water coolers, and will march past the BBC and down to College Green for a rally. That's tomorrow, 12 p.m. Well, I mean, we were talking earlier about people are not allowed to say that anything that Hamas says. You don't have to be a supporter of Hamas to say this is what Hamas is saying. It's perfectly logical that we need to know what they think. We need to know what the Russians think as well, and the Iranians.
No, all these people, Martin, you haven't understood this, have you? These are thought crimes, terrorist thought
crimes.
Yes,
indeed. We can see what's going on here. And the Green Party have obviously tried to cover themselves there. I would like to see what Mohammed have put up there, because he's a very sensible chap, and I don't suppose he will have said anything which is too out of order, but he's made to apologise, so he's apologised. This is bullying.
Some other people who can see what are going on are the thousands and thousands of students at the University of California in Los Angeles, and we'll hear also in this clip from what President Joe Biden has to say about them.
Free Palestine!
Free, free, free Palestine!
Free, free, free Palestine!
Free, free, free Palestine!
People be back. People will be back. Palestine. It's not the end. It's not going to be the end. Until the genocide ends and the funding for the genocide ends. The billions of dollars spent.
Destroying property is not a peaceful protest. It's against the law. Vandalism, trespassing, breaking windows, shutting down campuses, forcing the cancellation of classes and graduations. None of this is a peaceful protest. Threatening people, intimidating people, instilling fear in people is not a peaceful protest. It's against the law. There's the right to protest, but not the right to cause chaos.
You don't scare us, they say. We're not leaving. Obviously, there has been intervention by the Los Angeles police, and various universities in the States are in uprising. Now, some people have suggested it's all organised, but it seems to me it's much more likely to be that it's just reached critical mass now in the United States, that they've realised that many of the universities are financially tied to Israel.
I think that the repression that the US government has unleashed on the movement is... it's to be expected, but it's actually spread it. Yeah. What they probably should have done is ignored it and downplayed it. They've chosen, because they're under pressure from their Zionist financial backers, to go in hard and to give them a smack of firm government. Of course, what actually happened on the University of California's campus was that they were peacefully protesting in their encampment, and 200 pro-Israeli rioters turned up, not even students, and started throwing fireworks, brick bats and stones, and started beating people with baseball bats. The police stood by and watched that happen. Then they were intervened after it had been going on for several hours.
I've seen the same sort of thing here in the UK with the rave scene. So the police stand back, and the right-wing nutters with their baseball bats come in and start hitting the ravers.
Well, that's right. But what's eventually happened was the police were split the two sides apart. But don't forget, they've been saying there's been outside agitators coming into the universities, and these people were not even students, yeah, who turned up. Not even students, and they walked into the university and started beating up the students of the university.
Anyway,
the university, instead of protecting those students, has now evicted them from. But of course, these young students who are now getting criminal records and beaten over the head by the police, they are being radicalised. It's a whole generation of young people who are suddenly realising what sort of system they live in.
Well, maybe it's a bit like Hamas. This is going to be recruiting people in the anti-imperialist cause. Anyway, you asked specifically for a clip by Mario Savio, didn't you?
Mario Savio was a student leader in early 1960s University of California, and his famous speech about there comes a time when you have to throw yourselves on the wheels and the gears of the system in order to bring it to a halt. This time has arrived.
So
and
can you tell us the context of we're going to hear it in a minute, but why, before we do, let's
the context was that the Berkeley Free Speech Movement had started to set up encampments and continuous discussions about the war in Vietnam. And, for many years, the war had been going on for a while at that stage. Most people had just carried on putting up with it. But eventually, it was the universities where people said, look, this is no good. We can't carry on doing this. And they started to make protests. And, of course, they ran into exactly the sort of thing students are running into today, which is that the wider society and the establishment was determined to put them down. But, of course, it didn't work. And eventually, they won. And the people who were putting them down were proved wrong and they were proved right.
Yeah, he was around about 20 years old in 1963 when he gave this speech, which we're going to hear a bit. I mean, you can often hear this, but this is a slightly longer version, which gives a bit of the run-up to it too. So this is all about who runs and controls the university, really, isn't
it? That's right, yeah. He was making those points about what is a university. It shouldn't be run by big business, and it should be an independent space for thought. And, of course, he's a physicist. He wasn't a social sciences student, and he eventually became a professor of physics at the University of California. He died some years ago.
The grievances of people extend more than just the law, extend to a whole mode of arbitrary power, a whole mode of arbitrary exercise of arbitrary power. And that's what we have here. We have an autocracy which runs this university. It's managed. We were told the following. If President Kerr actually tried to get something more liberal out of the regents in his telephone conversations, why didn't he make some public statement to that effect? And the answer we received from a well-meaning liberal was the following. He said, would you ever imagine the manager of a firm making a statement publicly in opposition to his board of directors? That's the answer. Well, I ask you to consider, if this is a firm, and if the board of regents are the board of directors, and if President Kerr, in fact, is the manager, then I tell you something, the faculty are a bunch of employees, and we're the raw materials. But we're a bunch of raw materials that don't mean to have any process upon us, don't mean to be made into any product, don't mean to end up being bought by some clients of the university, be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone. We're human beings. And that brings me to the second mode of civil disobedience. There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Well, that's the key point of the speech. Because, of course, when he said that, you've got to throw yourselves on the gears and the wheels of the machine to stop it. It set a spark across US universities at the time. Ultimately, of course, leading to the killing of university students on Kent State University in 1970 by the National Guard. And we've got a similar situation. I mean, obviously, times change, and it's not quite the same. But it is interesting that when he was making that speech in the early 60s, probably only a minority of Americans had decided that the Vietnam War was no good.
But in 1963.
1963, so it's quite early. Today, if you look at opinion polls in the United States of America, 70% of them do not want, they want a ceasefire with Hamas, which is what everybody else is calling for. And of course, increasingly, the demand both here and in the US is we've got to stop arming Israel.
Sorry, it was 1964, just to get be accurate.
Yeah, that's but I mean, it's early. It's early on. Of course, that's why it was important, because it then set off the movement against the Vietnam War in the universities. And of course, it took over from what had been the previous big struggle of university students, which was a civil rights struggle for black emancipation and voting rights and so on. And of course, that had been kind of tolerated. But once they started speaking out against the war, then it started to become much more, much more visceral. Now, you've got a situation where they weren't really tolerated at the time, but it was regarded, you know, universities, I mean, he talks about in the rest of the speech, because we've heard the whole speech before on this show years ago, was about what university is and what it's for, and whether university should be controlled by
there,
big business.
Are we products that are kind of turned out of this machine for big business? The answer is no, we're human beings. And actually, it's one of the reasons I enjoyed my education, doing an English degree, was just purely for the joy of it, really, the getting to know the language.
Yes, and in any case, the point, I mean, in Latin America, of course, even in the most repressive countries like Nicaragua, the universities were regarded as off limits to the authorities. You know, it's a part of the tradition that you should be able to, in your university, if you're a university student, you should be able to have meetings about what you want to talk about, and you shouldn't be told what to think by anybody. That's the whole purpose of a university. And if it's not doing that, it ain't a university.
No,
well,
they're not. They've been basically privatised, turned into private machines.
Degree factories.
Yeah. Just winding up on Gaza now, an ode to a thousand words by Patrizio Opulenza this week. No god or good ever could be found in dwellings built on blood. As graves beneath each home e'er quake, memories in each brick awake. A conscience deep within each soul holds truth in heart which takes its toll on daily tasks, and never will find peace in buildings built at will. On death and blood and children's screams, no light e'er come from all that's been. A thousand words on page could write and still not find the words that might convey dismay of slaughter seen streamed live each day onto our screens. No past treaties agreed by stealth will ever give souls peace or wealth, nor foundations built on blood and bones will ever bring a peaceful home. No amount of bombs and guns can ever chase or truth outrun. Nakbar displacements, killing sprees in plain sight for all to see. Genocide streamed live now roams across the world into our home. A thousand words on page could write and still not find the words that might convey dismay of slaughter seen streamed live each day onto our screen. Ceasefire a bribe for 40 days will stop the genocide, they say. Pressure brought election year, but campus youths will not adhere. As children murdered, starved and burnt, protests just to prove no lessons learnt. Unless one state in fairness brings where equal rights like bird on wing in Palestine with God's good grace live side by side as human race. A thousand words on page could write and still not find the words that might convey dismay of slaughter scene streamed live each day on to our screen. Thanks very much, Patrizio. You sent me some other little words, which I'll forward on to our local Palestine Solidarity people here, which are really to do with sort of, sort of student-y chant type things, which maybe they'll pick up on those. We shall see. Anyway, on to Elizabeth Nixon now, Nikson. I spoke to her earlier this week. She's done a book called Eco-Fascism, and she starts off by saying actually she didn't really want to call it Eco-Fascism at all. Her past, she's been a journalist. She was telling me she spent 5 years or so working in London as Life magazine, and I start the long version of this interview off with her, and she says it was like being a duchess in London, you know, which made me laugh. She's being introduced to all the sort of most important people in the city and writing, but they all wanted to be in Life magazine, who she was working for at the time. But she's now retired in Western Canada on one of the islands out near Vancouver. She spoke to me from there earlier this week.
It wasn't actually my title. It was Adam Bellow's title. I don't know whether you know about him, but he is a very famous editor on the right. His father is Saul Bellow. He's published and edited some of the best writers of our time. And he also is, you know, he's a fervent anti-communist. So, you know, he was in many ways a shaper of the book. Of course, it was my ideas, my experience, my writing, and he hardly edited it at all. But it was his title. I wanted to sort of call it something about like the burning heartland, because it, to me, the real thing that was happening was that ordinary people were being destroyed across the American West, throughout the heartland, in every rural area in America. Ordinary people were being destroyed.
Can you just take us through like one story of what happened? Because I think it's, you know, you can talk about these in general terms, but sometimes it's important to focus in on just maybe one family and how they've been affected by the environmental movement.
Okay, so I'll just use the island that I live on, Salt Spring Island, as an example, because I think your listeners will be able to relate to it. We live about a two-hour ferry ride from Vancouver, half hour from Victoria, 2 hours from Seattle. We're four times the size of Bermuda, which has 500,000 visitors a year and 70,000 residents. We have 10,000 residents, and we might get 20,000 tourists in the summer. 95% of our land is under preservation of some kind or another. There is a 5-acre minimum rule. You cannot have houses on acreages smaller than 5 acres. So that has meant over time that the price of property here has, my house is worth a ridiculous amount of money. It's a ridiculous amount. It's merely because they have choked off growth and everybody wants to live here and nobody can afford it unless they're very, very rich. So we have 75-year-old women living in tents in the forest or in their cars, and little young women with children living in their cars, and it's disgusting. And no matter what we do, we cannot fight the regulation that's been put in place by the environmental movement. Now, I can go to Ferry County, which is a working class district in eastern Washington state. This is a massively forested area. Nobody in England can quite get the extent of the forest in the American Northwest. It is massive. It grows very, very fast. For many years, it was a going concern. So what happened when Clinton put in the spotted owl regulation, which was very, very bad science, all of those forested communities started shutting down, and they shut down in stages. So what would happen was that one family would go out of business, and then another family would go out of business, and then another family would go out of business, so that, you know.
Okay, so what was putting them out of business? Why were they going broke?
The forests were shut down. No more logging. No more logging, no more sawmills, no more producing of lumber, no more producing of paper. The forests, they were industrial forests. They were intended using 200-year-old German silviculture. I mean, it was very highly scientific management. And all of the forests were left standing. You couldn't clear, you couldn't let your sheep and cattle graze. You couldn't.
But you weren't allowed to thin them at all.
You couldn't thin them. You couldn't go in and get firewood. You couldn't hunt. It was just so all of this bounty was put off limits. So as time went on, the communities began to shrink, and all of the businesses would go at it, because one forestry job supports 7 other jobs. So that happened not just in the American West, but through the American Southwest and through the American South with ranching. And I mean, what you end up is, you know, Donald Trump. Those are the people that started supporting Donald Trump. because they were being ruined. And Trump is the only person, the only politician that for some reason understands it and mirrors those concerns. And because those concerns are so fundamental, this will never go away. It will never go away. There's no suppressing this. There's no stopping it until it's addressed, until resources are returned to the people who own it.
So what do you think's the ultimate object of this? Because it sounds to me as if it's going to be impossible for anyone to make a living in the countryside there.
Well, it's basically that's the case right now. Well, I mean, you know, I have connections who were in the Trump Department of Interior, and specifically, say, endangered species, which is the most powerful act outside of the cities in the U.S. and Canada, and they are able to use actual science and proven statistics. So how many bears? It's not this sort of panicked, we're killing everything hysteria that you get from the left, which is extraordinarily powerful, and it captures the imagination of every stupid woman on earth and every dumb kid, and just turns their minds into hysterical mush. And every time they shriek, another family dies. I mean, it really is as axiomatic as that. But in fact, during the Trump administration, a lot of that started to be reversed, and these people grabbed what growth they could. But since then, Biden has decreed that 30% of the United States is to be set off limit by 2030, and by 2050 it will be 50%, and by 2075 it'll be 75%. Everybody will be in the cities, the countryside will be off limits because everything has to regenerate. Species have to regenerate, and the air has to become decarbonized or carbonized. I don't know which it is. It's so stupid that I cannot even say the words.
So that's Elizabeth Nixon, N-I-C-K-S-O-N, speaking to me earlier this week, author of this book, Eco-Fascism, Martin. Now, I mean, surely you can have some sympathy with families who basically been regulated out of existence in many of these places. I mean, the what she's describing there, these forests of the American Northwest, are massive, and these families have bought bits of land there. They're now told, well, you can't do anything here anymore. You know, time to leave.
Well, back in the day when things were different, there was gradually a movement developed. And as she said, every stupid woman and every dumb kid started to believe that we've got to protect the environment. That may have led to excesses. But of course, this is actually a democratic society, and there are more people who think like that than think like her. And that's what she can't take. Now, the fact is that there's going to be a debate about
this. I suppose, are city people. They're all saying, well, actually, we want everyone in the country to come and live in the city. Do they really want that? Do people really want this?
Well, this is
enclosure, isn't it, of sorts? You know, which we had here with all the country folk being driven out of their homes and going into mass urbanisation.
Well, I imagine that most of the areas we're talking about used to be owned by Indian tribes, who've been eliminated.
Well, she does talk about that in the longer interview.
Yes, there we are.
Various trades were done with them, apparently, to take some of the land. But they've still got big reservations, Indian population.
I mean,
you may remember when I was actually over in Vancouver, I did an interview with some people over there who were talking about now they actually passed a law in Vancouver that this land is going back to Indians.
Well, there you are. The fact is that these things are contested. And in democratic societies, they're contested and people are entitled to their views.
It might be the Indians decide they're going to manage them and chop a few trees down and have a bit of lumber industry.
If they do, then that's what they do. But, I mean, these things are always contested, yeah? And I thought when we were going to talk about eco-fascism, we were talking about the ecological ideas of Hitler or whatever. But what we're talking about here is that there are people who push an ecological agenda in the United States, and we know who they are. They're powerful. The Sierra Club, for example, and all these other people. Lots of the students that have got possibly green tendencies. Jill Stein is going to be the Green Party candidate for president. She's of course Jewish and have been arrested at one of these protests in Washington. So there's going to be arguments and contest about this. She's putting forward a particular point of view. She's not happy with what's happening. She's saying that, these
well,
people voted
Trump.
It's not
just her, is it? I mean,
well, no, it's not just her.
It should be us too, saying it's not right to destroy these rural communities on the back of saying that this is green. It's not.
It depends, doesn't it? We didn't hear somebody from the other side saying, in actual fact, the logging industry was unsustainable. Don't forget, these trees do not just grow back. Once you've cut down some of these big old trees that you've got up there, they don't grow back. You don't get the ecology back.
As she explained there, they've been doing it for 200 years, excuse me.
Yes, and eventually...
This is German. They're using this German silviculture.
Yes, okay, but...
So they're thinning trees. They're not clear-cutting. And they have a rather nice logging industry.
All right.
I mean, you can understand certain areas, Yellowstone National Park or something being preserved. She's saying this is thousands and thousands of square miles of forest, and now no one's allowed to do anything there.
Well, she's not happy with it, but other people perhaps might like that.
Yeah, and other people, Donald Trump doesn't.
Yes, okay, well, there you are. So we're talking about political arguments people's different interests.
Part of this...
I might want to keep those forests to go walking in. You want to make money.
You can
money
still go walking when it's being managed, can't you?
Well, it depends if it's clear-cutting. You're saying it's not clear-cutting. But, of course, there used to be clear-cutting. That's exactly what used to happen.
That's not what silviculture does. They're not clear-cutting and managing. What they do is they thin and they replant. Okay. Anyway, so another... we'll have the Israelism. I've got that clip here, but we'll have that next week. This is a documentary that's just come out, which is fascinating about the sort of manic nationalism over in Israel and the way it stretches particularly over to the United States. But staying on this subject, we're going to hear a bit more from Elizabeth Nixon about talking about tattoos in a minute. But this is a part of a documentary called Stakeholder Communism. And also touching on this idea of green fascism.
BlackRock focused their investments in companies with good ESG scores.
At BlackRock, we are forcing behaviors.
That's an investment criteria for you.
If you don't force behaviors, whether it's gender or race, you're going to be impacted, and we're going to have to force change.
By starving non-compliant companies of funding, investor stakeholders, such as BlackRock, are forcing companies to adopt stakeholder capitalism.
This will allow investors to see how the company performs on matters such as climate change, workplace diversity and inclusion, and as a consequence, a sea change in the way companies are run.
One elite, who rejected his invite to the World Economic Forum and is sounding the alarm about ESG, is Elon Musk.
We know what basically is some sort of communism rebranded thing, which is like a lot of what ESG is, to be inflicted upon corporate America without the knowledge of the actual shareholders, which is what's going on. The public is being lied to.
Elon Musk tweeted, "I'm increasingly convinced that corporate ESG is the devil incarnate. People who follow the Great Reset and the World Economic Forums often warn against it."
Elon also tweeted,
"WEF is increasingly becoming an unelected world government that the people never asked for and don't want."
And,
"How is WEF Davos even a thing? Are they trying to be the boss of Earth?"
Criticizing our new boss of Earth will guarantee a poor ESG score.
Tesla, a company that makes electric vehicles, has a moderate to moderately poor score. Somehow, out of the five U.S.-based automotive companies like Ford, which make gas-guzzling trucks, Tesla's ESG score is the worst. Why is that? The score is political.
What I'm particularly proud of in the case of the development of those ESG metrics is that the initiative came from business, from our 100-plus CEOs.
And his 100-plus CEOs will, of course, be guaranteed a good score.
So the company reigning at the very top of the ESG scoring list is Bill Gates founded Microsoft.
With this metrics, the business world will finally be able to walk the talk on their commitment to ESG performance and the stakeholder principle.
Recently, I rejected a request from my investors to report ESG metrics for my startup. But according to Klaus Schwab, I may soon have no choice.
As regulators look set to mandate separate sustainability reporting requirements, we encourage all companies to join the Forum's Stakeholder Capitalism Metrics Initiative.
This mandate call to action is led by this middle stakeholder, the UK Prime Minister.
We're announcing the UK's intention to mandate climate disclosures by large companies and financial services firms across the economy by 2025.
By the end of 2023, the UK and several other countries had mandated large company environmental reporting.
And the UK, EU and Australia have announced reporting could be made mandatory for all companies in 2024.
With China as the model, ESG will likely evolve from scoring companies to scoring everyone, just like their social credit score.
So that's it's quite a fun documentary in a way, because they're saying, actually talking about this idea from the World Economic Forum, stakeholder capitalism, but they're calling it stakeholder communism. So I suppose what they're saying really is this is, you know, neither left nor right. It's actually just authoritarian. Do you know what this ESG stands for, Martin? I had to look it up.
Environmental something or other, I presume.
Environmental, social and governance criteria, okay. ESG. And all the big companies, apparently Microsoft scores higher than everybody. Whoopee! So this is apparently going to be used to steer all big companies towards these goals. And that's all a great for the environment and for their governance and for whole of society.
Well, Elon Musk, who's calling out stakeholder communism, he famously tweeted after the coup in Bolivia, because they've got big lithium deposits in Bolivia, there was a coup against the left-wing government. They've now been reinstated, or another version of the reinstated. We will coup who we like. Get over it. That was his view. So you've got the right wing in America who hate this stakeholder capitalism, stakeholder communism, and they've got the real left-wing people like me. I despise them all. We want real communism. Not stakeholder capitalism, real communism, or real socialism, as defined by Hudson, okay? I don't believe that the Microsoft or Elon Musk is going to save the planet. We're going to have to actually abolish Microsoft and Elon Musk.
What Musk actually said was, we will coup whoever we want. Deal with it.
Yes. So in other words, that's how unauthoritarian he is when he's saying that we don't want to be told what to do by the World Economic Forum. Well, now, I'm sure he doesn't. I don't want to be told by them either.
Well, you're just falling into the trap here it's not Musk versus World Economic Forum. They're both in it together, actually.
And also pretending to be against each other.
I think you're absolutely right there. So anyway, final clip with Elizabeth Nixon. And here she is, I think fascinatingly, talking about... I mean, this is one of the... I first picked up on her stuff. She's writing about tattoos and the prevalence of tattoos in the modern world.
The initial thing I came across by you was really looking at the prevalence of tattoos. Now, of course, this is something that many of us see nowadays. In fact, quite a lot of people who are at the extreme end of radical environmentalism. I've worked with people in the UK like Earth First. They were really into their tattoos for some reason, not quite sure why. And I would think of myself as someone that wouldn't even dream of doing that, because it's sort of, you're given this body. Well, why would you want to punch a load of holes in it and start scribbling on it? That's my thought. But why did you decide to write about tattoos, Elizabeth?
You know, it just kind of occurred to me that they were reverting to an earlier, more primitive form of human civilization, where everybody was in tribes, and they would propitiate their gods through human sacrifice and ritual, and Indian warriors would tattoo their bodies before a battle in order to inure themselves to the pain of battle. It's the same reason why I swim in 50-degree ocean water. It's because if I've done that day, I can pretty much do anything. So to me, it's a reversion to that. and to the ecstasy that kids propitiate or seek out in the music that they listen to and the raves that they have. I mean, I don't know about England, but out here in the West, there's a lot of sort of celebration in the forests that are, you know, that go on for 2 or 3 days, and everybody gets very, very high, or, you know, mostly very, very high, and dances all night. And I mean, it's a throwback to a more primitive way of life, which I think they celebrate because modernism has served them so badly.
So that's Elizabeth Nixon. Also, in that interview, she talks about human sacrifice as well, which is quite interesting. She thinks is kind of making a comeback. So I'll put that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later tonight. Final clip, Martin, is with a chap called Russell Brand. You know what happened to him this week?
No, tell
he's
me.
He's got baptized. Actually, sounds a lot more chilled out. He was very stressed out before. So that's our final clip of the evening. Let's have a listen to an extract from what Russell Brand had to say after he'd been baptized this week as a Christian.
If you have a loving relationship with a partner, that is where you'll find a great deal of solace. But I don't know how you feel. Sometimes the material world and human relationships, they're not enough. We report on this stuff every single day. Corruption, institutional corruption, violence, unnecessary wars, the refusal of the powerful to participate in peaceful solutions, the corruption of powerful groups, the desire of powerful interests to hide malevolent intent behind beneficial measures. We're doing this to help you, they say. It's for your safety and for your convenience. And my whole life long, I felt a calling and mistranslated it time after time as various forms of addiction, substance misuse and drinking too much, and an overwhelming urge to lose myself in concupiscence, continually looking for love in all the wrong places. And isn't it extraordinary, any of you that have experienced this already, to get baptized? Do you feel like, how can this ceremony have any real import? How can the gentle, or actually in my case, quite radical immersion beneath water, and in my case, a live river, make any real difference? How can the sins of the past be washed away? How can you be born again? How can you awaken anew? I suppose to answer that question, you have to inquire in what you consider the self to be, whether you're made up just of impulses and urges and memories, or whether or not you believe there is a ghost in the machine, or more likely a Holy Spirit if you're willing to invite it into your life. For me, I've reached a point in my life where, for a long while, in fact, I've known that the material world was not enough. And more than that, as many of you are surely already mouthing, it's not even about you. This I've learned as an addict in recovery, the pursuit of my own goals and my own agenda always leaves me cold and always leaves me empty and always leaves me wanting more. You can never have enough of what you don't really want. For me, this is a new discovery. It is a surrender undertaken in gratitude and in sincerity. And I know that it's not something I'll be able to undertake perfectly, but for the first time in my life, I fully understand that I'm not at the center of my universe. And I say that as a parent. I've got 3 really, really beautiful kids I'm devoted to and dedicated to. But now I know that my function here is to be of service and to be guided and to no longer be in autonomous or authoritative control of the measures and pursuits that are put before me. And that aligns so beautifully with what we do here on this show and on this channel. This is an opportunity for us to look at corruption in institutions, look at hypocrisy in media, look at a planet that seems to be in pretty serious trouble, and see how individually and collectively we can participate in an awakening. So for me, I've done what I believe is unavoidable, inevitable, necessary for me, for all of the exotic exploration, for all of the various drugs and substances, for all of the esoteric practices. I found it in that humble place that was at the end of my arm, at the end of my street, sat at bus stops, sat in churches, droned on about in school assemblies, in Christianity, and in particular in the figure of Christ. And I'm done proselytizing. Your journey will be your journey, but I'll be praying for you as many have been praying for me. And I appreciate all of your prayers, and I've felt your prayers, and I've been carried by your prayers, and I will do my best to honor your prayers. This is a conversation we can go on having because, hey, we're reading Mere Christianity as part of our book club. And if you become an awakened wonder, and obviously you're very welcome. And if it's not something you can afford, let us know. Send us an email at help@russellbrand.com and we'll give it to you for nothing.
Is that C.S. Lewis, Mere Christianity, I think? Anyway, well done. God bless Russell Brand. So interesting to see him taking that. And also, doesn't he sound kind of a bit more mellow? Maybe there has been some kind of spiritual transformation. I was a bit disappointed to see our pastor here in Bristol, Dia Moodley, who we covered a protest that, well, he didn't do a protest. He got arrested outside the university talking about abortion, saying something quite negative about it. Oh, well, you know, let's see. Is this really, you know, look, give the guy a break. You know, give him it. You are obliged to give him the benefit of the doubt. That's what we do. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest. That is particularly Elizabeth Nixon, and Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram if you dare. Do send me interviews and story tips via the Not the BCFM Politics Show page. Easiest thing to do in the world is if you're on Telegram, just share them there. And you'll find them. If I delete them, it's just because they're boring or because you're chit-chatting. But that's just part of the deal. When you'll also find the podcast, the full-length interviews, story links, comment page, and our email addresses. I'll put that link up to Elizabeth Nixon as well tonight at thisweek.org.uk. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on this stream, thisweek.org.uk. The actual stream, of course, is talkradio.org.uk, and over Sunday breakfast at Camberley's Radio QUK.com. Do please feel free to make live recordings, and the talkradio.org.uk stream next Friday, that's where we'll be. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokescroft Arts Centre in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, which I've mentioned about 10 times now, sorry, at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. Brand new version, thanks Nick, up on the... I would just suggest sometimes the best thing to do is just delete the old version rather than update it and install complete new one because it takes up less space and it probably works better. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable bank holiday weekend next week, isn't it? Do please, not this week, next week. Or is it this week, Dave? Sorry? Yeah, on Monday. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5 live. God bless. And don't let the satanic banksters, the accelerationists, identified by Russell Brand there, get you down.
She rolled me up and said, I look very strange without a head. It was time I should be gone, but I was waiting for John to take me home.
There is no dark side in the moon, really. Matter of fact, it's all dark.